Maybe that's not my name.
Maybe it is. Please call.
Be careful with that stuff, she said, pointing at the little aluminum packet. You're spacewalking, too.
Goodbye. Be careful.
Careful? What's that?
The bitter smile again.
Goodbye, Mr. Dawes. Thanks. You're good in bed. Do you mind me saying that? You are. Goodbye.
She slammed the door closed, crossed Route 7, and stood at the base of the turnpike entrance ramp. He watched her show a thumb to a couple of cars. Neither of them stopped. Then the road was clear and he U-turned, honking once. In the rearview mirror, he saw a small facsimile of her wave.
Silly twit, he thought, stuffed full of every strange conceit in the world. Still, when he put his hand out to turn on the radio, the fingers trembled. He drove back to the city, got on the turnpike, and drove 200 miles at 70. Once he almost threw the small aluminum packet out the window. Once he almost took the pill inside. At last he just put it in his coat pocket. When he got home, he felt washed out, empty of emotion. The 784 extension had progressed during the day. In a couple of weeks, the laundry would be ready for the wrecking ball. They had already taken out the heavy equipment. Tom Granger had told him about that in an odd, stilted phone conversation 3 nights ago. When they leveled it, he would spend the day watching. He would even pack a bag lunch. There was a letter for Mary from her brother in Jacksonville. He didn't know about the split then. He put it aside absently with some other mail for Mary that he kept forgetting to forward. He put a TV dinner in the oven and thought about making himself a drink. He decided not to. He wanted to think about his sexual encounter with the girl the night before, relish it, explore its nuances. A few drinks and it would take on the unnatural, fevered color of a bad sex movie. Restless co-eds. ID required. And he didn't want to think of her like that. But it wouldn't come. Not the way he wanted it. He couldn't remember the precise, tight feel of her breasts, or the secret taste of her nipples. He knew that the actual friction of intercourse had been more pleasurable with her than with Mary. Olivia had been a snugger fit, and once his penis had popped out of her vagina with an audible sound, like the pop of a champagne cork. But he couldn't really say what the pleasure had been. Instead of being able to feel it, he wanted to masturbate. The desire disgusted him. Furthermore, his disgust disgusted him. She wasn't holy, he assured himself as he sat down to eat his TV dinner. Just a tramp on the bum. To Las Vegas yet. He found himself wishing that he could view the whole incident with Magliore's jaundiced eye, and that disgusted him most of all. Later that night he got drunk in spite of all his good intentions, and around 10 o'clock the familiar maudlin urge to call Mary rose up in him. He masturbated instead, in front of the TV, and came to climax while an announcer was showing incontrovertibly that Anison hit and held the highest pain relief level of any brand. December 8, 1973. He didn't go riding Saturday. He wandered uselessly around the house, putting off the thing that had to be done. At last, he called the home of his in-laws. Lester and Jean Calloway, Mary's parents, were both nearing their 70s. On his previous calls, Jean, who Charlie had always called Mama Jean, had answered the telephone, her voice freezing to ice chips when she realized who was on the line. To her, and to Lester also, undoubtedly, he was like some animal that had run amok and bitten her daughter. Now the animal kept calling up, obviously drunk, whining for their girl to come back so he could bite her again. He heard Mary herself answer.
Hello?
With enough relief so he could talk normally. Me, Mary.
Oh, Bart. How are you?
Impossible to read her voice.
Fair.
How are the Southern Comfort Supplies holding out?
Mary, I'm not drinking.
Is that a victory?
She sounded cold, and he felt a touch of panic, mostly that his judgment had been impossibly bad. Could someone he had known so long and whom he thought he knew so well be slipping away so easily?
I guess it is, he said lamely.
I understand the laundry had to close down, she said.
Probably just temporary. He had the weird sensation that he was riding in an elevator, conversing uncomfortably with someone who regarded him as a bore.
That isn't what Tom Granger's wife said.
There. Accusation at last. Accusation was better than nothing. Tom won't have any problem. The competition uptown has been after him for years, the bright, clean people. He thought she sighed.
Why did you call, Bart?
I think we ought to get together, he said carefully. We have to talk this over, Mary.
Do you mean a divorce?
She said it calmly enough, but he thought it was her voice in which he sensed panic now. Do you want one?
I don't know what I want.
Her calm fractured, and she sounded angry and scared.
I thought everything was fine. I was happy, and I thought you were. Now all at once that's all changed.
You thought everything was fine, he replied. He was suddenly furious with her. You must have been pretty stupid if you thought that. Did you think I kicked away my job for a practical joke, like a high school senior throwing a cherry bomb into a toilet?
Then what is it, Bart? What happened?
His anger collapsed like a rotten yellow snowbank, and he found that there were tears beneath. He fought them, grimly, feeling betrayed. This wasn't supposed to happen, sober. When you were sober, you should be able to keep fucking control of yourself, but here he was, wanting to spill out everything and sob on her lap like a kid with a busted skate and a skinned knee. But he couldn't tell her what was wrong because he didn't precisely know, and crying without knowing was too much like it's time for the loony bin stuff. I don't know, he said finally.
Charlie?
Helplessly, he said, if that was part of it, how could you be so blind to the rest of it?
I miss him too, Bart. Still. Every day.
Resentment again. You've got a funny way of showing it, then. This is no good, he said finally. Tears were trickling down his cheeks, but he had kept them out of his voice. Gentlemen, I think we've got it licked, he thought, and almost cackled. Not over the phone. I called to suggest lunch on Monday. Handy Andy's.
All right. What time?
It doesn't matter. I can get off work. The joke fell to the floor and died bloodlessly there.
1 o'clock?
She asked. Sure. I'll get us a table.
Reserve one. Don't just get there at 11 and start drinking.
I won't, he said humbly, knowing he probably would. There was a pause. There seemed nothing else to say. Faintly, almost lost in the hum of the open wire, ghostly other voices discussed ghostly other things. Then she said something that surprised him totally.
Bart, you need to see a psychiatrist.
I need a what?
Psychiatrist. I know how that sounds, just coming out flat, but I want you to know that whatever we decide, I won't come back and live with you unless you agree.
Goodbye, Mary, he said slowly. I'll see you on Monday.
Bart, you need help I can't give.
Carefully, inserting the knife as well as he could over 2 miles of blind wire, he said, I knew that anyway. Goodbye, Mary. He hung up before he could hear the result and caught himself feeling glad. Game, set, and match. He threw a plastic milk pitcher across the room and caught himself feeling glad that he hadn't thrown something breakable. He opened the cupboard over the sink, yanked out the first 2 glasses his hands came to, and threw them on the floor. They shattered. Baby, you fucking baby, he screamed at himself. Why don't you just hold your fucking breath until you turn fucking blue? He slammed his right fist against the wall to shut out the voice and cried out at the pain. He held his wounded right in his left and stood in the middle of the floor, trembling. When he had himself under control, he got a dustpan and the broom and swept the mess up, feeling scared and sullen and hungover. December 9, 1973. He got on the turnpike, drove 150 miles, and then drove back. He didn't dare drive any farther. It was the first gasless Sunday, and all the turnpike pit stops were closed, and he didn't want to walk. See, he told himself, this is how they get shitbirds like you, Georgie. Fred, is that really you? To what do I owe the honor of this visit, Freddy? Fuck off, buddy. On the way home, he heard this public service ad on the radio.
So you're worried about the gasoline shortage, and you want to make sure that you and your family aren't caught short this winter. So now you're on your way to your neighborhood gas station with a dozen five-gallon cans. But if you're really worried about your family, you better turn around and go back home. Improper storage of gasoline is dangerous. It's also illegal, but never mind that for a minute. Consider this. When gasoline fumes mix with the air, they become explosive, and 1 gallon of gas has the explosive potential of 12 sticks of dynamite. Think about that before you fill those cans. And then think about your family. You see, we want you to live.
This has been a public service announcement from WLDM. The music people remind you to leave gasoline storage to the people who are equipped to do it properly. He turned off the radio, slowed down to 50, and pulled back into the cruising lane. 12 sticks of dynamite, he said. Man, that's amazing. If he had looked into the rearview mirror, he would have seen that he was grinning. December 10, 1973. He got to Handy Andy's at just past 11:30, and the head waiter gave him a table beside the stylized bat wings that led to the lounge. Not a good table, but one of the few empties left as the place filled up for lunch. Handy Andy specialized in steaks, chops, and something called the Andy Burger, which looked a little like a chef's salad stuck between a huge sesame seed roll with a toothpick to hold the whole contraption together. Like all big city restaurants within executive walking distance, it went through indefinable cycles of inness and outness. 2 months ago, he could have come in here at noon and had his pick of tables. 3 months hence, he might be able to do the same. To him, it had always been one of life's minor mysteries, like the incidents in the books of Charles Fort, or the instinct that always brought the swallows back to Capistrano. He looked around quickly as he sat down, afraid he would see Vinnie Mason or Steve Ordner or some other laundry executive. But the place was stuffed with strangers. To his left, a young man was trying to persuade his girl that they could afford 3 days in Sun Valley this February. The rest of the room's conversation was just soft babble, soothing.
"A drink, sir?"
The waiter was at his elbow.
"Scotch rocks, please," he said.
"Very good, sir," the waiter said. He made the first one last until noon, killed 2 more by 12:30, and then, just mulishly, he ordered a double. He was just draining it dry when he saw Mary walk in and pause in the door between the foyer and the dining room, looking for him. Heads turned to look at her, and he thought, "Mary, you ought to thank me. You're beautiful." He raised his right hand and waved. She raised her hand in return greeting and came to his table. She was wearing a knee-length wool dress, soft patterned gray. Her hair was braided in a single thick cable that hung down to her shoulder blades, a way he could not recall having seen her wear it, and maybe worn that way for just that reason. It made her look youthful, and he had a sudden guilty flash of Olivia, working beneath him on the bed he and Mary had shared so often.
"Hello, Bart," she said.
"Hi. You look awful pretty."
"Thanks."
"Do you want a drink?"
"No, just an Andy Burger. How long have you been here?"
"Oh, not long."
The lunch crowd had thinned, and his waiter appeared almost at once.
"Would you like to order now, sir?"
"Yes. 2 Andy Burgers, milk for the lady, another double for myself." He glanced at Mary, but her face showed nothing. That was bad. If she had spoken, he would have canceled the double. He hoped he wouldn't have to go to the bathroom because he wasn't sure he could walk straight. That would be a wonderful tidbit to carry back to the old folks at home. "Carry me back to old Virginny," he almost giggled.
"Well, you're not drunk, but you're on your way,"
she said, and unfolded her napkin on her lap.
"That's pretty good," he said. "Did you rehearse it?"
"Bart, let's not fight."
"No," he agreed.
She toyed with her water glass. He picked at his coaster.
"Well?"
she said finally.
"Well, what?"
"You seem to have something in mind when you called. Now that you're full of Dutch courage, what is it?"
"Your cold is better," he said idiotically, and tore a hole in his coaster without meaning to. He couldn't tell her what was on the top of his mind. How she seemed to have changed.
how she seemed suddenly sophisticated and dangerous, like a cruising secretary who has bartered for a later lunch hour and who would refuse any offer of a drink unless it came from a man inside a $400 suit, and who could tell just by glancing at the cut of the fabric.
Bart, what are we going to do?
I'll see a psychiatrist if you want me to, he said, lowering his voice.
When?
Pretty soon.
You can make an appointment this afternoon if you want to.
I don't know any.
There's the Yellow Pages.
That seems like a half-assed sort of way to pick a brain peeker. She only looked at him, and he looked away, uncomfortable.
You're angry with me, aren't you? She asked.
Yeah, well, I'm not working. $50 an hour seems sort of high for an unemployed fellow.
What do you think I'm living on? She asked sharply. My folks' charity. And, as you'll recall, they're both retired.
As I recall, your father's got enough shares in SOI and Beechcraft to keep the three of you on Easy Street well into the next century.
Bart, that's not so.
She sounded startled and hurt. Bullshit, it's not. They were in Jamaica last winter, Miami the year before that, at the Fountain Blue, no less, and Honolulu the year before that. Nobody does that on a retired engineer's salary, so don't give me that poor box routine, Mary.
Stop it, Bart. The green showing.
Not to mention a Cadillac Grand Deville and a Bonneville station wagon. Not bad. Which one do they use when they go to pick up their food stamps?
Stop it!
She hissed at him, her lips drawn back a bit from her small white teeth, her fingers gripping the edge of the table. Sorry, he muttered.
Lunch is coming.
The temperature between them cooled a little as the waiter set their Andy burgers and French fries before them, added minuscule dishes of green peas and baby onions, then retired. They ate without speaking for a while, both concentrating on not drooling down their chins or in their laps. I wonder how many marriages the Andy burger has saved, he wondered, simply by its one providential attribute. When you're eating one, you have to shut up. She put hers down half-eaten, blotted her mouth with her napkin, and said,
"They're as good as I remember." Bart, do you have any sensible idea at all about what to do?
Of course I do, he said, stung. But he didn't know what his idea was. If he'd gotten in another double, he might have.
Do you want a divorce?
No, he said. Something positive seemed to be called for.
Do you want me to come back?
Do you want to?
I don't know,
she said.
Shall I tell you something, Bart? I'm worried about myself for the first time in 20 years. I'm fending for myself.
She started to take a bite of her Andy burger, then set it down again.
Did you know I almost didn't marry you? Had that thought ever crossed your mind?
The surprise on his face seemed to satisfy her.
I didn't think it had. I was pregnant, so of course I wanted to marry you. But part of me didn't. Something kept whispering that it would be the worst mistake of my life. So I roasted myself over a slow fire for 3 days, throwing up every morning when I woke up, hating you for that, thinking this, that, and the other. Run away. Get an abortion. Have the baby and put it up for adoption. Have the baby and keep it. But I finally decided to do the sensible thing. The sensible thing.
She laughed.
And then lost the baby anyway.
Yes, you did, he muttered, wishing the conversation would turn from this. It was too much like opening a closet and stepping into puke.
But I was happy with you, Bart.
Were you? He asked automatically. He found he wanted to get away. This wasn't working. Not for him, anyway.
Yes, but something happens to a woman in marriage that doesn't happen to a man. Do you remember when you were a child, how you never worried about your parents? You just expected them to be there, and they were. Same as the food and the heat and the clothes.
I guess so. Sure.
And I went and got my silly self pregnant. And for 3 days, a whole new world opened up around me.
She was leaning forward, her eyes glowing and anxious, and he realized with dawning shock that this recitation was important to her, that it was more than getting together with her childless friends
or deciding which pair of slacks to buy in Banbury's, or guessing which celebrities Merv would be chatting with at 4:30. This was important to her. And had she really gone through 20 years of marriage with only this one important thought? Had she? She had almost said as much. 20 years, my God! He felt suddenly sick to his stomach. He liked the image of her picking up the empty bottle and waving it at him gleefully from her side of the road so much better.
"I saw myself as an independent person,"
she was saying.
"An independent person, with no one to explain myself to or subordinate myself to, no one around to try and change me, because I knew I could be changed. I was always weak that way. But also no one to fall back on when I was sick or scared or maybe broke. So I did the sensible thing, like my mother and her mother, like my friends. I was tired of being a bridesmaid and trying to catch the bouquet. So I said yes, which was what you expected, and things went on. There were no worries. And when the baby died, and when Charlie died, there was you. And you were always good to me. I know that. I appreciate that. But it was a sealed environment. I stopped thinking. I thought I was thinking, but I wasn't. And now it hurts to think. It hurts."
She looked at him with bright resentment for a minute, and then it faded.
"So I'm asking you to think for me, Bart. What do we do now?"
"I'm going to get a job," he lied.
"A job?"
"And see a psychiatrist. Mary, things are going to be fine. Honest. I was a little off the beam, but I'm going to get back on. I'm..."
"Do you want me to come home?"
"In a couple of weeks, sure. I just have to get things together a little, and..."
"Home? What am I talking about? They're going to tear it down. What am I talking about, home? Jesus!"
she groaned.
"What a mess! Why did you have to drag me into such a shitty mess?"
He couldn't stand her this way. She wasn't like Mary, not at all. "Maybe they won't," he said, taking her hand across the table. "Maybe they won't tear it down, Mary. They might change their minds. If I go and talk to them, explain the situation, they might just..." She jerked her hand away. She was looking at him, horrified.
"Bart!"
she whispered.
"What?"
He broke off, uncertain. What had he been saying? What could he possibly have been saying to make her look so awful?
"You know they're going to tear it down. You knew it a long time ago. And we're sitting here going around and around..."
"No, we're not," he said. "We're not. Really. We're not. We... But what were they doing? He felt unreal.
"Bart, I think I better go now."
"I'm going to get a job."
"I'll talk to you."
She got up hastily, her thigh bumping the edge of the table, making the silverware gossip. "The psychiatrist, Mary, I promise."
"Mama wanted me to go to the store."
"Then go on," he shouted at her, and heads turned. "Get out of here, you bitch. You had the best of me, and what have I got? A house the city's going to rip down. Get out of my sight." She fled. The room was horribly quiet for what seemed like eternity. Then the talk picked up again. He looked down at his dripping, half-eaten hamburger, trembling, afraid he was going to vomit. When he knew he was not, he paid the check and left without looking around. December 12, 1973. He made out a Christmas list the night before, drunk, and was now downtown filling an abridged version. The completed list had been staggering, over 120 names, including every relative near and distant that he and Mary had between them, a great many friends and acquaintances, and, at the bottom, God save the Queen, Steve Ordner, his wife, and their, for Christ's sakes, maid. He had pruned most of the names from the list, chuckling bemusedly over some of them, and now strolled slowly past windows filled with Christmas goodies, all to be given in the name of that long-ago Dutch thief who used to slide down people's chimneys and steal everything they owned. One gloved hand patted a $500 roll of $10 bills in his pocket.
He was living on the insurance money, and the first $1,000 of it had melted away with amazing speed. He estimated that he would be broke by the middle of March at this rate, possibly sooner, but found the thought didn't bother him at all. The thought of where he might be or what he might be doing in March was as incomprehensible as calculus. He went into a jewelry store and bought a beaten silver owl pin for Mary. The owl had coldly flashing diamond chips for eyes. It cost $150, plus tax. The sales lady was effusive. She was sure his wife was going to love it. He smiled. There goes 3 appointments with Dr. Psycho, Freddy. What do you think about that? Freddy wasn't talking. He went into a large department store and took an escalator up to the toy department, which was dominated by a huge electric train display. Green plastic hills honeycombed with tunnels, plastic train stations, overpasses, underpasses, switching points, and a Lionel locomotive that bustled through all of it, puffing ribbons of synthetic smoke from its stack and hauling a long line of freight cars, B&O, Soo Line, Great Northern, Great Western, Warner Brothers, Diamond International, Southern Pacific. Young boys and their fathers were standing by the wooden picket fence that surrounded the display, and he felt a warm surge of love for them that was untainted by envy. He felt he could have gone to them, told them of his love for them, his thankfulness for them, and the season. He would also have urged them to be careful. He wandered down an aisle of dolls and picked one up for each of his 3 nieces, Chatty Cathy for Tina, Maisie the acrobat for Cindy, and a Barbie for Sylvia, who was 11 now. In the next aisle he got a G.I. Joe for Bill, and, after some deliberation, a chess set for Andy. Andy was 12, an object of some worry in the family. Old B. from Baltimore had confided in Mary that she kept finding stiff places on Andy's sheets. Could it be possible? So early? Mary had told B. that children were getting more precocious every year. B. said she supposed it was all the milk they drank, and vitamins, but she did wish Andy liked team sports more, or summer camp, or horseback riding, or anything. Never mind, Andy, he thought, tucking the chess set under his arm. You practice knight's gambits and queen to rook 4 and beat off under the table if you want to. There was a huge Santa Claus throne at the front of the toy department. The throne was empty, and a sign was propped on an easel in front of it. The sign said, Santa is having lunch at our famous Midtown Grill. Why not join him? There was a young man in a denim jacket and jeans looking at the throne, his arms full of packages, and when the young man turned around, he saw it was Vinnie Mason. Vinnie, he said. Vinnie smiled and colored a little, as if he had been caught doing something a bit nasty. Hello, Bart, he said, and walked over. There was no embarrassment over shaking hands. Their arms were too full of packages. Christmas shopping a little? He asked Vinnie. Yeah, he chuckled. I brought Sharon and Bobby, that's my daughter Roberta, over to look on Saturday. Bobby's 3 now. We wanted to get her picture taken with Santa Claus. You know, they do that on Saturdays, just a buck. But she wouldn't do it. Cried her head off. Sharon was a little upset. Well, it's a strange man with a big beard. The little ones get scared sometimes. Maybe she'll go to him next year. Maybe. Vinnie smiled briefly. He smiled back, thinking it was much easier with Vinnie now. He wanted to tell Vinnie not to hate his guts too much. He wanted to tell Vinnie he was sorry if he had fucked up Vinnie's life. So what are you doing these days, Vinnie? Vinnie absolutely beamed. You won't believe this. It's so good. I'm managing a movie theater, and by next summer I'll be handling 3 more. Media Associates? It was one of the corporation's companies. That's right. We're part of the Cinemate releasing chain. They send in all the movies, proven box office stuff, but I'm handling the Westfall Cinema completely. They're going to add on? Yeah, Cinema 2 and 3 by next summer. And the Beacon Drive-In, I'll be handling that too. He hesitated. Vinnie, you tell me if I'm stepping out of line, but if this Cinemate outfit picks the films and books them, then what exactly do you do? Well, handle the money, of course, and order stuff. That's very important. Did you know that the candy stand alone can almost pay for one night's film rental if it's handled efficiently?
Then there's maintenance and, he swelled visibly, and hiring and firing. It's going to keep me busy. Sharon likes it because she's a big movie freak, especially Paul Newman and Clint Eastwood. I like it because all of a sudden I jump from 9,000 to 11,005.
He looked at Vinny dully for a moment, wondering if he should speak. This was Ordner's prize, then.
Good, doggy. Here's the bone. Get out of it, Vinny, he said. Get out of it, just as quick as you can.
What, Bart?
Vinny's brow wrinkled in honest puzzlement.
Do you know what the word gopher means, Vinny?
Gopher? Sure. It's a little animal that digs holes.
No, gopher. G-O-F-E-R.
I guess I don't know that one, Bart. Is it Jewish?
No, it's white collar. It's a person who does errands. A glorified office boy. Go for coffee. Go for Danish. Go for a walk around the block, Sonny. Go for.
What are you talking about, Bart?
I mean that Steve Ordner kicked your special case around with the other members of the board, the ones who matter anyway, and said, listen, fellas, we've got to do something about Vincent Mason, and it's a delicate sort of case. He warned us that Bart Dawes was riding a rubber bike. And even though Mason didn't swing quite enough weight to enable us to stop Dawes before he screwed up the waterworks, we owe this Mason something. But of course we can't give him too much responsibility. And do you know why, Vinny?
Vinny was looking at him resentfully.
I know I don't have to eat your shit anymore, Bart. I know that.
He looked at Vinny earnestly.
I'm not trying to shit you. What you do doesn't mean anything to me anymore, but Christ's sakes, Vinny, you're a young man. I don't want to see him fuck you over this way. The job you've got is a short-term plum, a long-term lemon. The toughest decision you're going to have is when to reorder buttercup containers and Milky Ways. And Ordner's going to see that it stays that way as long as you're with the corporation.
The Christmas spirit, if that was what it had been, curdled in Vinny's eyes. He was clutching his packages tightly enough to make the wrappings crackle, and his eyes were gray with resentment. Picture of a young man who steps out his door whistling, ready for the evening's heavy date, only to see all four tires on his new sports car have been slashed. And he's not listening. I could play him tapes and he still wouldn't believe it.
As it turned out, you did the responsible thing, he went on. I don't know what people are saying about me now.
They're saying you're crazy, Bart,
Vinny said in a thin, hostile voice. That word's as good as any. So you were right, but you were wrong, too. You spilled your guts. They don't give positions of responsibility to people who spill their guts, not even when they were right to do it, not even when the corporation suffers because of their silence. Those guys on the 40th floor, Vinny, they're like doctors. And they don't like loose talk any more than doctors, like an intern that goes around blowing off about a doctor who muffed an operation because he had too many cocktails at lunch.
You're really determined to mess up my life, aren't you? Vinny asked. But I don't work for you anymore, Bart. Go waste your poison on someone else.
Santa Claus was coming back, a huge bag slung over one shoulder, bellowing wild laughter and trailing small children like party-colored exhaust.
Vinny, Vinny, don't be blind. They're sugarcoating the pill. Sure, you're making 11.5 this year. And next year, when you pick up the other theaters, they'll buck you up to maybe 14,000. And there you'll be, 12 years from now, when you can't buy a lousy Coke for 30 cents. Go for that new carpeting. Go for that consignment of theater seats. Go for those reels of film that got sent across town by mistake. Do you want to be doing that shit when you're 40, Vinny? With nothing to look forward to but a gold watch?
Better than what you're doing.
Vinny turned away abruptly, almost bumping Santa, who said something that sounded suspiciously like, watch where the fuck you're going. He went after Vinny. Something about the set expression on Vinny's face convinced him he was getting through, despite the defensive emplacements.
God, God, he thought, let it be.
Leave me alone, Bart. Get lost.
Get out of it, he repeated. If you wait, even until next summer, it may be too late. Jobs are going to be tighter than a virgin's chastity belt if this energy crisis goes into high gear, Vinny. This may be your last chance.
Vinny
wheeled around.
I'm telling you for the last time, Bart.
You're flushing your future right down the john, Vinny. Life's too short for that. What are you going to tell your daughter when...
Vinny punched him in the eye. A bolt of white pain flashed up into his head and he staggered backward, arms flying out. The kids who had been following Santa scattered as his packages, dolls, G.I. Joe, chess set, went flying. He hit a rack of toy telephones, which sprayed across the floor. Somewhere a little girl screamed like a hurt animal, and he thought, "Don't cry, darling. It's just dumb old George falling down. I do it frequently around the house these days." And someone else, jolly old Santa maybe, was cursing and yelling for the store detective. Then he was on the floor amid the toy telephones, which all came equipped with battery-powered tape loops, and one of them was saying over and over in his ear, "Do you want to go to the circus? Do you want to go to the circus? Do you?" December 17, 1973. The shrilling of the telephone brought him out of a thin, uneasy afternoon sleep. He had been dreaming that a young scientist had discovered that by changing the atomic composition of peanuts just a little, America could produce unlimited quantities of low-polluting gasoline. It seemed to make everything all right, personally and nationally, and the tone of the dream was one of burgeoning jubilation. The phone was a sinister counterpoint that grew and grew until the dream split open and let in an unwelcome reality. He got up from the couch, went to the phone, and fumbled it to his ear. His eye didn't hurt anymore, but in the hall mirror he could see that it was still colorful.
"Hello?"
"Hi, Bart. Tom."
"Yeah, Tom. How are you?"
"Fine. Listen, Bart, I thought you'd want to know. They're demolishing the Blue Ribbon tomorrow."
His eyes snapped wide.
"Tomorrow? It can't be tomorrow. They... Hell, it's almost Christmas."
"That's why."
"But they're not up to it yet."
"It's the only industrial building left in the way," Tom said. "They're going to raise it before they knock off for Christmas."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes. They had a news feature on that morning program, City Day."
"Are you going to be there?"
"Yeah,"
Tom said.
"Too much of my life went by inside that pile for me to be able to stay away."
"Then I guess I'll see you there."
"I guess you will."
He hesitated.
"Listen, Tom, I want to apologize. I don't think they're going to reopen the Blue Ribbon in Waterford or any place else. If I screwed you up royally..."
"No, I'm not hurting. I'm up at Bright Clean, doing maintenance. Shorter hours, better pay. I guess I found the rose in the shit heap."
"How is it?"
Tom sighed across the wire.
"Not so good," he said. "But I'm past 50 now. It's hard to change. It would have been the same in Waterford."
"Tom, about what I did."
"I don't want to hear about it, Bart."
Tom sounded uncomfortable.
"That's between you and Mary, really."
"Okay.
You getting along good?"
"Sure. I've got a couple of things on the line."
"I'm glad to hear that."
Tom paused so long that the silence on the line became thick, and he was about to thank him for calling and hang up when Tom added,
"Steve Ordner called up about you. Called me right up at my house."
"Is that so? When?"
"Last week. He's pissed like a bear at you, Bart. He kept asking if any of us had any idea you had been sandbagging the Waterford plant. But it was more than that. He was asking all sorts of other things."
"Like what?"
"Like, did you ever take stuff home? Office supplies and stuff like that. Did you ever draw from petty cash without putting in a voucher? Or get your laundry done on the company clock? He even asked me if you had any kind of kickback deal going with the motels."
"That son of a bitch," he said wonderingly.
"Like I say, he's hunting around for a nice raw cob to stick up your pump, Bart. I think he'd like to find a criminal charge he could get you on."
"He can't. It's all in the family, and the family's broken up now."
"It broke up a long time ago,"
Tom said evenly,
"when Ray Tarkington died. I don't know anyone who's pissed off at you but Ordner. Those guys downtown, it's just dollars and cents to them. They don't know nothing about the laundry business, and they don't care to know."
He could think of nothing to say.
"Well,
Tom sighed.
I thought you ought to know. I suppose you heard about Johnny Walker's brother.
Arnie? No. What about him?
Killed himself.
What? Tom sounded as if he might be sucking back spit through his upper plate.
Ran a hose from the exhaust pipe of his car into the back window and shut everything up. The newsboy found him.
Holy God, he whispered. He thought of Arnie Walker sitting in the hospital waiting room chair and shivered as if a goose had walked over his grave. That's awful.
Yeah.
That sucking noise again.
Listen, I'll be seeing you, Bart.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
Glad to do it. Bye.
He hung up slowly, still thinking of Arnie Walker and that funny, whining gasp Arnie had made when the priest hurried in. Jesus, he had his picks. Did you see it? Oh, that's too bad, he said to the empty room, and the words fell dead as he uttered them, and he went to the kitchen to fix himself a drink. Suicide. The word had a hissing, trapped sound, like a snake squirming through a small crevice. It slipped between the tongue and the roof of the mouth like a convict on the lam. Suicide. His hand trembled as he poured Southern Comfort, and the neck of the bottle chattered against the rim of the glass. Why did he do that, Freddy? They were just a couple of old farts who roomed together. Jesus Christ, why would anybody do that? But he thought he knew why. December 18, 1973. He got to the laundry around 8 in the morning, and they didn't start to tear it down until 9. But even at 8, there was quite a gallery on hand, standing in the cold with their hands thrust into their coat pockets and frozen breath pluming from their mouths like comic strip balloons. Tom Granger, Ron Stone, Ethel Diamond, the shirt girl who usually got tipsy on her lunch break and then burned the hell out of unsuspecting shirt collars all afternoon, Gracie Floyd and her cousin Maureen, both of whom had worked on the ironer, and 10 or 15 others. The highway department had put out yellow sawhorses and smudge pots and large orange and black signs that said, Detour. The signs would route traffic around the block. The sidewalk that fronted the laundry had been closed off, too. Tom Granger tipped a finger at him but didn't come over. The others from the laundry glanced at him curiously and then put their heads together. A paranoid's dream, Freddy. Who will be the first to trot over and scream, J'accuse, in my face? But Fred wasn't talking. Around 9:15, a new 74 Toyota Corolla pulled up, the 10-day plate still taped in the rear window, and Vinnie Mason got out, resplendent and a little self-conscious in a new camel's hair overcoat and leather gloves. Vinnie shot him a sour glance that would have bent steel nails out of plumb, and then walked over to where Ron Stone was standing with Dave and Pollock. At 9:10, they brought a crane up the street, the wrecking ball dangling from the top of the gantry like some disembodied Ethiopian teat. The crane was rolling very slowly on its 10 chest-high wheels, and the steady, crackling roar of its exhaust beat into the silvery chill of the morning like an artisan's hammer shaping a sculpture of unknown import. A man in a yellow hard hat directed it up over the curb and through the parking lot, and he could see the man high up in the cab changing gears and clutching with one block-like foot. Brown smoke pumped from the crane's overhead stack. A weird, diaphanous feeling had been haunting him ever since he had parked the station wagon 3 blocks over and walked here. A simile that wouldn't quite connect. Now, watching the crane halt at the base of the long brick plant, just to the left of what had been the loading bays, the sense of it came to him. It was like stepping into the last chapter of an Ellery Queen mystery, where all the participants have been gathered so that the mechanics of the crime could be explained and the culprit unmasked. Soon, someone, Steve Ordner most likely, would step out of the crowd, point at him, and scream, "He's the one! Bart Dawes! He killed the Blue Ribbon!" At which point he would draw his pistol in order to silence his nemesis, only to be riddled with police bullets. The fancy disturbed him. He looked toward the road to assure himself and felt a sinking elevator sensation in his belly as he saw Ordner's bottle-green Delta 88,
parked just beyond the yellow barriers, exhaust pluming from the twin tailpipes. Steve Ordner was looking calmly back at him through the polarized glass. At that moment, the wrecking ball swung through its arc with a low, ratcheting scream, and the small crowd sighed as it struck the brick wall and punched through with a hollow, booming noise like detonating cannon fire. By 4 that afternoon, there was nothing left of the Blue Ribbon but a jumbled pile of brick and glass, through which protruded the shattered main beams, like the broken skeleton of some exhumed monster. What he did later, he did with no conscious thought of the future or consequences. He did it in much the same spirit that he had bought the 2 guns at Harvey's gun shop a month earlier, only there was no need to use the circuit breaker because Freddy had shut up. He drove to a gas station and filled up the LTD with high test. Clouds had come in over the city during the day, and the radio was forecasting a storm, 6 to 10 inches of new snow. He drove back home, parked the station wagon in the garage, and went down cellar. Under the stairs, there were 2 large cartons of returnable soda and beer bottles, the top layer covered with a thick patina of dust. Some of the bottles probably went back 5 years. Even Mary had forgotten about them in the last year or so, and had given up pestering him about taking them back for the refund. Most of the stores didn't even accept returnables now. Use them once, throw them away. What the hell? He stacked the 2 cartons, one on top of the other, and carted them out to the garage. When he went back to the kitchen to get a knife, a funnel, and Mary's floor-washing pail, it had begun to spit snow. He turned on the garage light and took the green plastic garden hose off its nail, where it had been looped since the 3rd week of September. He cut off the nozzle and it fell to the cement floor with a meaningless clink. He paid out 3 feet and cut it again. He kicked the rest away and looked at the length of hose thoughtfully for a moment. Then he unscrewed his gas cap and slipped the hose gently in like a delicate lover. He had seen gas siphoned before, knew the principle, but had never done it himself. He steeled himself for the taste of gasoline and sucked on the end of the hose length. For a moment there was nothing but an invisible, glutinous resistance, and then his mouth filled with a liquid so cold and foreign that he had to stifle an impulse to gasp and draw some of it down his throat. He spat it out with a grimace, still tasting it on his tongue like some peculiar death. He tilted the hose over Mary's floor bucket, and a stream of pinkish gasoline spurted into the bottom. The flow fell away to a trickle, and he thought he would have to go through the ritual again, but then the flow strengthened a bit and remained constant. Gas flowed into the bucket with a sound like urination in a public toilet. He spat on the floor, rinsed the inside of his mouth with saliva, spat again. Better. It came to him that, although he had been using gasoline almost every day of his adult life, he had never been on such intimate terms with it. The only other time he had actually touched it was when he had filled the small tank of his Briggs & Stratton lawnmower to the overflow point. He was suddenly glad that this had happened. Even the residual taste in his mouth seemed okay. He went back into the house while the bucket filled, it was snowing harder now, and got some rags from Mary's cleaning cupboard under the sink. He took them back into the garage and tore them into long strips, which he laid out on the hood of the LTD. When the floor bucket was half full, he switched the hose into the galvanized steel bucket he usually filled with ashes and clinkers to spread in the driveway when the going was icy. While it filled, he put 20 beer and soda bottles in 4 neat rows and filled each one 3/4 full, using the funnel. When that was done, he pulled the hose out of the gas tank and poured the contents of the steel pail into Mary's bucket. It filled it almost to the brim. He stuffed a rag wick into each bottle, plugging the necks completely. He went back to the house, carrying the funnel. The snow filled the earth in slanting, wind-driven lines. The driveway was already white. He put the funnel into the sink, and then got the cover that fitted over the top of the bucket from Mary's cupboard. He took it back to the garage and snapped it securely over the gasoline. He opened the LTD's tailgate and put the bucket of gasoline inside. He put his Molotov cocktails into one of the cartons, fitting them snugly, one against the other, so they would stand at attention like good soldiers. He put the carton on the passenger seat up front, within hand's reach. Then he went back into the house, sat down in his chair, and turned on the Zenith TV with the Space Command module. The Tuesday movie of the week was on. It was a Western,
starring David Janssen. He thought David Janssen made a shitty cowboy. When the movie was over, he watched Marcus Welby treat a disturbed teenager for epilepsy. The disturbed teenager kept falling down in public places. Welby fixed her up. After Marcus came station identification and two ads, one for Miracle Chopper and one for an album containing 41 spiritual favorites, and then the news. The weatherman said it was going to snow all night and most of tomorrow. He urged people to stay home. The roads were treacherous, and most snow removal equipment wouldn't be able to get out until after 2 a.m. High winds were causing the snow to drift, and generally, the weatherman hinted, things were going to be an all-around bitch kitty for the next day or so. After the news, Dick Cavett came on. He watched half an hour of that and then turned the TV off. So Ordner wanted to get him on something criminal, did he? Well, if he got the LTD stuck after he did it, Ordner would have his wish. Still, he thought his chances were good. The LTD was a heavy car, and there were studded tires on the back wheels. He put on his coat and hat and gloves in the kitchen entry, and paused for a moment. He went back through the warmly lighted house and looked at it. The kitchen table, the stove, the dining room bureau with the teacups hung from the runner above it, the African violet on the mantel in the living room. He felt a warm surge of love for it, a surge of protectiveness. He thought of the wrecking ball roaring through it, belting the walls down to junk, shattering the windows, vomiting debris over the floors. He wasn't going to let that happen. Charlie had crawled on these floors, had taken his first steps in the living room, had once fallen down the front stairs and scared the piss out of his fumbling parents. Charlie's room was now an upstairs study, but it was in there that his son had first felt the headaches and experienced the double vision and smelled those odd aromas, sometimes like roasting pork, sometimes like burning grass, sometimes like pencil shavings. After Charlie had died, almost 100 people had come to see them, and Mary had served them cake and pie in the living room. No, Charlie, he thought. Not if I can help it. He ran the garage door up and saw there was already 4 inches of snow in the driveway, very powdery and light. He got in the LTD and started it up. He still had over 3/4 of a tank. He let the car warm up, and sitting behind the wheel in the mystic green glow of the dash lights, he fell to thinking about Arnie Walker. Just a length of rubber hose. That wasn't so bad. It would be like going to sleep. He had read somewhere that carbon monoxide poisoning was like that. It even brought the color up in your cheeks, so you looked ruddy and healthy, bursting with life and vitality. He began to shiver, the goose walking back and forth across his grave again, and he turned on the heater. When the car was toasty and the shivering had stopped, he slipped the transmission into reverse and backed out into the snow. He could hear the gasoline sloshing in Mary's floor pail, reminding him that he had forgotten something. He put the car in park again and went back to the house. There was a carton of paper matches in the bureau drawer, and he filled his coat pockets with perhaps 20 folders. Then he went back out. The streets were very slippery. There was patch ice under the new snow in places, and once when he braked for a stoplight at the corner of Crestallen and Garner, the LTD slewed around almost sideways. When he brought the skid to a stop, his heart was thudding dully against his ribs. This was a crazy thing to be doing, all right. If he got rear-ended with all that gasoline in the back, they could scrape him up with a spoon and bury him in a dog food box. Better than suicide. Suicide's a mortal sin. Well, that was the Catholics for you. But he didn't think he would get hit. Traffic had thinned almost to the vanishing point, and he didn't even see any cops. Probably they were all parked in alleys, cooping. He turned cautiously onto Kennedy Promenade, which he supposed he would always think of as Dumont Street, which it had been until a special session of the City Council had changed it in January 1964. Dumont/Kennedy Prom ran from west side all the way downtown, roughly parallel to the 784 construction for almost 2 miles. He would follow it for a mile, then turn left onto Grand Street. A half mile up, Grand Street became extinct, just like the old Grand Theater itself. Might it rest in peace.
By next summer, Grand Street would be resurrected in the form of an overpass, one of the three he had mentioned to Magliori. But it wouldn't be the same street. Instead of seeing the theater on your right, you would only be able to see six, or was it eight, lanes of traffic hurrying by down below. He had absorbed a great deal about the extension from radio, TV, and the daily paper, not through any real conscious effort, but almost by osmosis. Perhaps he had stored the material instinctively, the way a squirrel stores nuts. He knew that the construction companies who had contracted the extension were almost through with the actual road work for the winter, but he also knew that they expected to complete all the necessary demolitions, there's a word for you, Fred. But Fred didn't pick up the gauntlet. Within the city limits by the end of February, that included Crestallen Street West. In a way, it was ironic. If he and Mary had been located a mile farther away, they would not have been liable to demolition until late in the spring, May, or early June of 1974. And if wishes were horses, beggars would sit astride golden palominos. He also knew, from personal conscious observation, that most of the road machinery was left parked below the point where Grand Street had been murdered. He turned onto Grand Street now, the rear end of the car trying to wander out from under him. He turned with the skid, jockeying the car, cajoling it with his hands, and it purred on, cutting through snow that was almost virgin. The tracks of the last car to pass this way were already fuzzy and indistinct. The sight of so much fresh snow somehow made him feel better. It was good to be moving, to be doing. As he moved up Grand at a steady, unhurried 25, his thoughts drifted back to Mary and the concept of sin, moral and venial. She had been brought up Catholic, had gone to a parochial grammar school, and although she had given up most religious concepts, intellectually, at least, by the time they met, some of that gut stuff had stuck with her. The stuff they sneak to you in the clinches. As Mary herself said, the nuns had given her 6 coats of varnish and 3 of wax. After the miscarriage, her mother had sent a priest to the hospital so that she could make a good confession, and Mary had wept at the sight of him. He had been with her when the priest came in carrying his pyx, and the sound of his wife's weeping had torn his heart as only one thing had done in the time between then and now. Once, at his request, she had reeled off a whole list of mortal and venial sins. Although she had learned them in catechism classes 20, 25, even 30 years before, her list seemed, to him at least, complete and faultless. But there was a matter of interpretation that he couldn't make clear. Sometimes an act was a mortal sin, sometimes only venial. It seemed to depend on the perpetrator's frame of mind. The conscious will to do evil. Was that something she had said during those long-ago discussions, or had Freddy whispered it in his ear just now? It puzzled him, worried him. The conscious will to do evil. In the end, he thought he had isolated the two biggies, the two hard and fast mortal sins, suicide and murder. But a later conversation, had it been with Ron Stone? Yes, he believed it had. Had even blurred half of that. Sometimes, according to Ron, they had been drinking in a bar, it seemed, as long as 10 years ago. Murder itself was only a venial sin. Or maybe not a sin at all. If you cold-bloodedly planned to do away with somebody who had raped your wife, that might just be a venial sin. And if you killed somebody in a just war, those were Ron's exact words. You could almost hear him speaking them in some mental taproom. Then it wasn't a sin at all. According to Ron, all the American GIs that had killed Nazis and Japs were going to be okay when the judgment trump blew. That left suicide. That hissing word. He was coming up to the construction. There were black and white barriers with round flashing reflectors on top, and orange signs that glowed briefly and brightly in his headlights. One said, "Road ends temporarily." Another said, "Detour. Follow signs." Another said, "Blasting area. Turn off two-way radios." He pulled over, put the transmission lever in park, turned on his four-way flashers, and got out of the car. He walked toward the black-and-white barriers. The orange blinkers made the falling snow seem thicker, absurd with color. He also remembered being confused about absolution,
At first he had thought it was fairly simple. If you committed a mortal sin, you were mortally wounded, damned. You could Hail Mary until your tongue fell out, and you would still go to hell. But Mary said that wasn't always so. There was confession, and atonement, and reconsecration, and so on. It was very confusing. Christ had said there was no eternal life in a murderer. But he had also said, "Whosoever believeth in me shall not perish." Whosoever. It seemed that there were as many loopholes in biblical doctrine as there were in a shyster lawyer's purchase agreement. Except for suicide, of course. You couldn't confess suicide, or repeat suicide, or atone for it, because that act cut the silver cord and sent you plunging out into whatever worlds there were. And why was he thinking about it anyway? He didn't intend to kill anybody, and certainly he didn't intend to commit suicide. He never even thought about suicide. At least, not until just lately. He stared over the black and white barriers, feeling cold inside. The machines were down there, hooded in snow, dominated by the wrecking crane. In its brooding immobility, it had gained a dimension of awfulness. With its skeletal gantry rising into the snowy darkness, it reminded him of a praying mantis that had gone into some unknown period of winter contemplation. He swung one of the barriers out of the way. It was very light. He went back to the car, got in, and pulled the transmission lever down into low. He let the car creep forward over the edge and down the slope, which had been worn into smooth ridges by the comings and goings of the big machines. With dirt underneath, the tendency of the heavy car to slip around was reduced. When he got to the bottom, he shifted back into park and turned off all the car's lights. He climbed back up the slope, puffing, and put the barrier back in place. He went back down. He opened the LTD's tailgate and took out Mary's bucket. Then he went around to the passenger seat and set the bucket on the floor beneath his carton of firebombs. He took the white lid off the bucket and, humming softly, dipped each wick in gasoline. That done, he carried the bucket of gas over to the crane and climbed up into the unlocked cab, being careful not to slip. He was excited now, his heartbeat hurrying along, his throat tight and close with bitter exultation. He splashed gas over the seat, over the controls, over the gearbox. He stepped out on the narrow, riveted catwalk that skirted the crane's motor hood and poured the rest of the gas into the cowling. Hydrocarbon perfume filled the air. His gloves had soaked through, wetting his hands and turning them numb almost immediately. He jumped down and stripped the gloves off, putting them into his overcoat pockets. The first packet of matches dropped from his fingers, which felt as distant as wood. He held on to the second pack, but the wind snuffed the first two he had scratched. He turned his back to the wind, hunched over the match folder protectively, and got one to stay lighted. He touched it to the rest, and they hissed into flame. He tossed the burning matches into the cab. At first he thought they must have gone out because there was nothing. Then there was a soft explosive sound. Frump! And fire boiled out of the cab in a furious gust, driving him back two steps. He shielded his eyes from the bright orange flower opening up there. An arm of fire ran out of the cab, reached the engine hood, paused for a moment as if in reflection, and then sniffed inside. This time the explosion was not soft. Ka-ploom! And suddenly the cowling was in the air, rising almost out of sight, fluttering and turning over. Something whizzed past his head. "It's burning," he thought. "It's really burning." He began to do a shuffling dance in the fiery darkness, his face contorted in an ecstasy so great that it seemed his features must shatter and fall in a million smiling pieces. His hands curled into waving fists above his head. "Hooray!" he screamed into the wind, and the wind screamed back at him. "Hooray! God damn it! Hooray!" He dashed around the car and slipped in the snow and fell down, and that might have saved his life, because that was when the gas tank of the crane blew debris in a 40-foot circle. A hot piece of metal winged through the right window of the LTD, punching a stellated hole in the safety glass and sending out a drunken spiderweb of cracks. He picked himself up, frosted with snow all the way down his front, and scrambled behind the wheel. He put his gloves back on, fingerprints. But after that, any thought of caution was gone. He started the car with fingers that could barely feel the ignition key, and then heavy-footed the accelerator, dragging out, they had called it when they had been kids, and the world was young. The rear end of the station wagon whipping left and right. The crane was burning furiously, better than he ever would have imagined. The cab, an inferno. The big windshield, gone.
Hot damn, he screamed. Oh, Freddy, hot damn!
He skated the LTD in front of the crane, the firelight sketching his face in two-tone Halloween colors. He rammed his right index finger at the dashboard, hitting the cigarette lighter on the third try. The construction machines were on his left now, and he rolled down his window. Mary's floor bucket rolled back and forth on the floor, and the beer and soda bottles chattered frantically against one another as the wagon jounced across the gouged and frozen earth. The cigarette lighter popped out, and he slammed both feet down on the power brake. The station wagon looped the loop and came to a stop. He pulled the lighter out of its socket, took a bottle from the carton, and pressed the glowing coil against the wick. It flared a light, and he threw it. It shattered against the mud-caked tread of a bulldozer, and flames splashed gaudily. He pushed the cigarette lighter back in, drove 20 feet farther, and threw three more at the dark hulk of a payloader. One missed. One struck the side and spilled burning gasoline harmlessly into the snow, and the third arced neatly into the cab.
"Fucking bullseye!" he screamed.
Another bulldozer, a smaller payloader. Then he came to a house trailer up on Jack's. A sign over the door said, "Lane Construction Company, on-site office. No hiring done here. Please wipe your feet." He pulled the LTD up at point-blank range and threw four burning bottles at the large window beside the door. They all went through, the first shattering the glass of both window and bottle, dragging a burning drape in after it. Beyond the trailer, a pickup truck was parked. He got out of the LTD, tried the pickup's passenger door, and found it unlocked. He lit the wick of one of his bombs and pitched it inside. Flames leaped hungrily across the bench seat. He got back into his car and saw there were only four or five bottles left. He drove on, shivering in the cold, snot running from his nose, reeking of gasoline, grinning. A steam shovel. He pitched the rest of the bottles at it, doing no damage until the last, which blew one of the tractor treads loose from its aft cog. He probed the box again, remembered it was empty, and looked in the rearview mirror.
"Motherfuck!" he cried. "Oh, holy motherfuck! Freddy, you cockknocker!"
Behind him, a line of isolated bonfires stood out in the snow-choked darkness like runway landing lights. Flames were belching madly from the windows of the office trailer. The pickup was a ball of fire. The cab of the payloader was an orange cauldron. But the crane was really the masterpiece. Because the crane was a roaring yellow beacon of light, a sizzling torch in the middle of the roadwork.
"Demo-fucking-lition!"
he screamed. A semblance of sanity began to return. He dared not go back the way he had come. The police would be on the way soon, maybe already. And the fire department. Could he get out ahead? Or was he blocked in? Heron Place. He might be able to get up to Heron Place. It would be a 25-degree angle up the slope, maybe 30, and he would have to crash the wagon through a highway department barrier. But the guardrails were gone. He thought maybe he could do it. Yes, he could do it. Tonight, he could do anything. He drove the LTD up the unfinished roadbed, skidding and slewing, using only his parking lights. When he saw the streetlights of Heron Place above and to the right, he fed the car more and more gas and watched the speedometer needle climb past 30, as he aimed at the embankment. It was near 40 when he hit the incline and shot up. About halfway, the rear wheels began to lose traction, and he dropped the transmission lever into low. The engine dropped a note, and the car hitched forward. He was almost nose over the top when the wheels began to spin again, machine-gunning snow and pebbles and frozen clods of earth out behind him. For a moment, the issue was in doubt. And then the simple forward inertia of the LTD, coupled with willpower, perhaps, carried it up onto level ground. The nose of the car bunted the black-and-white barrier aside. It toppled backward into a snowdrift, making a dreamy sugar puff. He went down over the curb and was almost shocked to realize that he was on a normal street again, as if nothing at all had happened. He shifted back to drive and settled down to a sedate 30. He was getting ready to turn toward home when he remembered that he was leaving tracks that plows or new snow might not obliterate for 2 hours or more. Instead of turning up Crest Allen Street, he continued out Heron Place to River Street, and then down river to Route 7. Traffic here had been light ever since the snow had begun to come hard, but there had been enough to chew the snow covering the highway into a loose, churned-up mess. He merged his tail with that of all the other cars that were moving east, and inched his speed up to 40. He followed Route 7 for almost 10 miles, then back into the city, and drove toward Crest Allen Street. A few plows were out now, moving through the night like gigantic orange mastiffs with glaring yellow eyes. Several times he looked toward the 784 construction, but in the blowing snow he could see nothing. About halfway home he realized that even though all the windows were rolled up and the heater was on full blast, the car was still cold. He looked back and saw the jagged hole in the rear passenger side window. There was broken glass and snow on the back seat. "Now how did that happen?" he asked himself, bewildered. He honestly had no recollection. He entered his street from the north and drove directly to his house. It was as he had left it, the single light in his kitchen, the only light shining on this whole darkened section of street. There were no police cars parked out front, but the garage door was open, and that was just plain stupid. You close the garage door when it snowed, always. That's why you have a garage, to keep the elements off your stuff. His father used to say that. His father had died in a garage, just like Johnny's brother. But Ralph Dawes had not committed suicide. He had had some kind of stroke. A neighbor had found him, with his lawn clippers in his stiffening left hand, and a small whetstone by his right. A suburban death. Oh, Lord, send this white soul to a heaven where there is no crabgrass and the niggers always keep their distance. He parked the station wagon, pulled the garage door down, and went into the house. He was trembling from exhaustion and reaction. It was 3:15. He hung his coat and hat in the hall closet and was closing the door when he felt a hot jolt of terror, as riveting as a straight knock of Scotch whiskey. He fumbled wildly in his overcoat pockets and let out a whistling sigh when he felt his gloves, still soaked with gasoline, each of them crushed into a soggy little ball. He thought of making coffee and decided against it. He had a queasy, thumping headache, probably caused by gasoline fumes and helped along by his scary drive through the snowy darkness. In his bedroom, he took off his clothes and threw them over a chair without bothering to fold them. He thought he would fall asleep as soon as his head touched the pillow, but it was not so. Now that he was home, and presumably safe, staring wakefulness seized him. It brought fear like a handmaiden. They were going to catch him and put him in jail. His picture would be in the papers. People who knew him would shake their heads and talk it over in cafeterias and lunchrooms. Vinnie Mason would tell his wife that he had known Dawes was crazy all along. Mary's folks would maybe fly her to Reno, where she would first pick up residency and then a divorce. Maybe she would find somebody to fuck her. He wouldn't be surprised. He lay wakeful, telling himself they weren't going to catch him. He had worn his gloves, no fingerprints. He had Mary's bucket and the white cover that went over the top. He had hidden his tracks, had shaken off possible pursuit just as a fugitive will throw off the bloodhounds by walking in a creek. None of these thoughts brought him sleep or comfort. They would catch him. Perhaps someone on Heron Place had seen his car and thought it suspicious that any vehicle should be out so late on such a stormy night. Perhaps someone had jotted down his license plate number and was even now being congratulated by the police. Perhaps they had gotten paint scrapings from the Heron Place construction barrier and were now cajoling his guilty name out of some auto registration computer. Perhaps... He rolled and thrashed in his bed, waiting for the dancing blue shadows to come in his window, waiting for the heavy knock on his door, waiting for some bodiless, Kafka-esque voice to call, "Okay, open up in there!" And when he finally fell asleep, he did it without knowing it, because thought continued without a break, shifting from conscious rumination to the skewed world of dreams with hardly a break, like a car going from drive to low. Even in his dreams he thought he was awake. And in his dreams he committed suicide over and over, burned himself, bludgeoned himself by standing under an anvil and pulling a rope, hanged himself, blew out the stove's pilot lights and then turned on the oven and all four burners, shot himself, defenestrated himself, stepped in front of a speeding Greyhound bus, swallowed pills, swallowed vanished toilet bowl disinfectant, stuck a can of Glade Pine Fresh aerosol in his mouth, pushed the button, and inhaled until his head floated off into the sky like a child's balloon. Committed Harry Carey while kneeling in a confessional at St. Dom's, confessing his self-murder to a dumbfounded young priest even as his guts accordioned out onto the bench like beef stew, performing an act of contrition in a fading, bemused voice as he lay in his blood and the steaming sausages of his intestines. But most vividly, over and over, he saw himself behind the wheel of the LTD, racing the engine a little in the closed garage, taking deep breaths and leafing through a copy of National Geographic, examining pictures of life in Tahiti and Auckland and the Mardi Gras in New Orleans, turning the pages ever more slowly until the sound of the engine faded to a faraway sweet hum and the green waters of the South Pacific inundated him in rocking warmth and took him down to a silver fathom.
December 19, 1973. It was 12:30 in the afternoon when he woke up and got out of bed. He felt as though he had been on a huge bender. His head ached monstrously. His bladder was cramped and full. There was a dead snake taste in his mouth. Walking made his heart thud like a snare drum. He was not even allowed the luxury of believing, for however short a time, that he had dreamed everything he remembered of the previous night, because the smell of gasoline seemed rubbed into his flesh, and it rose fulsomely fragrant from the pile of his clothes. The snow was over, the sky was clear, and the bright sunshine made his eyes beg for mercy. He went into the bathroom, sat on the ring, and a huge diarrhea movement rushed out of him like a mail train highballing through a deserted station. His waist fell into the water with a sickening series of jets and plops that made him groan and clutch his head. He urinated without getting up, the rich and dismaying smell of his digestion's unsavory end product rising thickly around him. He flushed and went downstairs on his orange wood legs, taking clean clothes with him. He would wait until the god-awful smell cleared out of the bathroom, and then he would shower, maybe all afternoon. He gobbled 3 Excedrin from the green bottle on the shelf over the kitchen sink, then washed them down with 2 big gulps of Pepto-Bismol. He put on hot water for coffee and smashed his favorite cup by fumbling it off its hook. He swept it up, put out another, dumped instant Maxwell House into it, and then went into the dining room. He turned on the radio and swept across the dial looking for news, which, like a cop, was never there when you needed it. Pop music. Feed and grain reports. A golden nugget 'cause you dug it. A call-in talk show. A swap shop program. Paul Harvey selling bankers' life insurance. More pop music. No news. The water for the coffee was boiling. He set the radio to one of the pop stations and brought his coffee back to the table and drank it black. There was an inclination to vomit with the first 2 mouthfuls, but after that it was better. The news came on, first national, then local. On the city news front, a fire was set at the site of the 784 Thruway Extension construction near Grand Street in the early hours of this morning. Police Lieutenant Henry King said that vandals apparently used gasoline bombs to fire a crane, 2 payloaders, 2 bulldozers, a pickup truck, and the on-site office of the Lane Construction Company, which was entirely gutted. An exultation as bitter and dark as the taste of his unsweetened coffee closed his throat at the words, "entirely gutted." Damage done to the payloaders and bulldozers was minor, according to Francis Lane, whose company got a substantial subcontracting bid on the crosstown extension, but the demolition crane values at $60,000 and is expected to be out of service for as long as 2 weeks. 2 weeks? Was that all? More serious, according to Lane, was the burning of the on-site office, which contained timesheets, work records, and 90% of the company's cost accounting records over the last 3 months. This is going to be the very devil to straighten out, Lane said. It may set us back a month or more. Maybe that was good news. Maybe an extra month of time made it all worthwhile.
According to Lieutenant King, the vandals fled the construction site in a station wagon, possibly a late-model Chevrolet. He appealed for anyone who may have seen the car leaving the construction area by Heron Street to come forward. Francis Lane estimated total damage in the area of $100,000. In other local news, State Representative Muriel Reston again appealed for...
He snapped it off. Now that he had heard, and had heard in daylight, things seemed a little better. It was possible to look at things rationally. Of course, the police didn't have to give out all their leads, but if they really were looking for a Chevy instead of a Ford, and if they were reduced to pleading for eyewitnesses to come forward, then maybe he was safe, at least for the time being. And if there had been an eyewitness, no amount of worrying would change that. He would throw away Mary's floor bucket and open the garage to air out the stink of gasoline, make up a story to explain the broken back window if anyone asked about it, and most important, he would try to prepare himself mentally for a visit from the police. As the last resident of Crest Allen Street West, it might be perfectly logical for them to at least check him out, and they wouldn't have to sniff up his back trail very far to find out he had been acting erratically. He had screwed up the plant, his wife had left him, a former co-worker had punched him out in a department store. And, of course, he had a station wagon, Chevrolet or not. All bad, but none of it proof. And if they did dig up proof, he supposed he would go to jail. But there were worse things than jail. Jail wasn't the end of the world. They would give him a job, feed him. He wouldn't have to worry about what was going to happen when the insurance money ran out. Sure, there were a lot of things worse than jail. Suicide, for instance. That was worse. He went upstairs and showered. Later that afternoon, he called Mary. Her mother answered and went to get Mary with a sniff. But when Mary herself answered, she sounded nearly gay.
"Hi, Bart. Merry Christmas in advance."
"No, Merry Christmas," he responded. It was an old joke that had graduated from humor to tradition.
"Sure," she said. "What is it, Bart?"
"Well, I've got a few presents, just little stuff, for you and the nieces and nephews. I wondered if we could get together somewhere. I'll give them to you. I didn't wrap the kids' presents."
"I'd be glad to wrap them, but you shouldn't have. You're not working."
"But I'm working on it," he said.
"Bart, have you done anything about what we talked about?"
"The psychiatrist?"
"Yes."
"I called two. One is booked up until almost June. The other guy is going to be in the Bahamas until the end of March. He said he could take me then."
"What were their names?"
"Names? Gee, honey, I'd have to look them up again to tell you. Adams, I think the first guy was. Nicholas Adams."
"Bart,"
she said sadly. "It might have been Aaron's," he said wildly.
"Bart," she said again.
"Okay," he said. "Believe what you want. You will anyway."
"Bart, if you'd only..."
"What about the presents?" "I called about the presents, not the goddamn shrink." She sighed.
"Bring them over Friday, why don't you? I can..."
"What? So your mother and father can hire Charles Manson to meet me at the door? Let's just meet on neutral ground, okay?"
"They're not going to be here," she said. "They're going to spend Christmas with Joanna."
Joanna was Joanna St. Clair, Jean Calloway's cousin, who lived in Minnesota. They had been close friends in their girlhood, back in that pleasant lull between the War of 1812 and the advent of the Confederacy, he sometimes thought. And Joanna had had a stroke in July. She was still trying to get over it, but Jean had told him and Mary that the doctor said she could go at any time. That must be nice, he thought, having a time bomb built right into your head like that. "Hey, bomb, is it today?" "Please, not today. I haven't finished the new Victoria Holt."
"Bart, are you there?"
"Yes, I was wool gathering."
"Is 1 o'clock all right?"
"That's fine."
"Was there anything else?"
"No. Uh-uh."
"Well?"
"Take good care, Mary."
"I will. Bye, Bart."
"Goodbye." They hung up, and he wandered into the kitchen to make himself a drink. The woman he had just talked to on the phone wasn't the same woman that had sat tearfully on the living room couch less than a month ago, pleading for some reason to help explain the tidal wave that had just swept grandly through her ordered life. destroying the work of 20 years and leaving only a few sticks poking out of the mudflats. It was amazing. He shook his head over it the way he would have shaken his head over the news that Jesus had come down from the sky and had taken Richard Nixon up to heaven upon wheels of fire. She has regained herself. More, she had regained a person he hardly knew at all, a girl woman he barely remembered. Like an archaeologist, she had excavated that person, and the person was a little stiff in the joints from his long storage, but still perfectly usable. The joints would ease, and the new old person would be a whole woman, perhaps scarred by this upheaval, but not seriously hurt. He knew her perhaps better than she thought, and he had been able to tell, strictly from the tone of her voice, that she was moving ever closer to the idea of divorce, the idea of a clean break with the past, a break that would splint well and leave no trace of a limp. She was 38. Half of her life was ahead of her. There were no children to be casually maimed in the car wreck of this marriage. He would not suggest divorce, but if she did, he would agree. He envied her new person and her new beauty. And if she looked back 10 years from now on her marriage as a long, dark corridor leading into sunlight, he could feel sorry she felt that way, but he couldn't blame her. No, he couldn't blame her. December 21, 1973. He had given her the presents in Gene Calloway's ticking Ormolu living room, and the conversation that followed had been stilted and awkward. He had never been in this room alone with her, and he kept feeling that they should neck. It was a rusty, knee-jerk reaction that made him feel like a bad double exposure of his college self. "Did you lighten your hair?" he asked.
"Just a shade,"
she shrugged a little. "It's nice. Makes you look younger."
"You're getting a little gray around the temples, Bart. Makes you look distinguished."
"Bullshit. It makes me look ratty." She laughed, a little too high-pitched, and looked at the presents on the little side table. He had wrapped the owl pen, had left the toys and the chess set for her to do. The dolls looked blankly at the ceiling, waiting for some little girl's hands to bring them to life. He looked at Mary. Their eyes caught seriously for a moment, and he thought irrevocable words were going to spill out of her, and he was frightened. Then the cuckoo jumped out of the clock, announced 1:30, and they both jumped and then laughed. The moment had passed. He got up so it wouldn't come around again. Saved by a cuckoo bird, he thought. That fits. "Got to go," he said.
"An appointment?"
"Job interview."
"Really?"
She looked glad.
"Where? Who? How much?"
He laughed and shook his head. "There's a dozen other applicants with as good a chance as me. I'll tell you when I get it."
"Conceited."
"Sure."
"Bart, what are you doing Christmas?"
She looked concerned and solemn, and it suddenly came to him that an invitation to Christmas dinner and not to some New Year's divorce court had been the thing on her lips inside. "God!" He almost sprayed laughter. "I'm going to eat at home."
"You can come here," she said. "It would be just the two of us."
"No," he said thoughtfully, and then more firmly. "No. Emotions have a way of getting out of hand during the holidays. Another time." She was nodding, also thoughtfully. "Will you be eating alone?" he asked.
"I can go to Bob and Janet's. Really, are you sure?"
"Yes."
"Well..."
But she looked relieved. They walked to the door and shared a bloodless kiss. "I'll call you," he said.
"You better."
"And give my best to Bobby."
"I will."
He was halfway down the walk to the car when she called,
"Bart! Bart, wait a minute!"
He turned almost fearfully.
"I almost forgot," she said. "Wally Hamner called and invited us to his New Year's party. I accepted for both of us. But if you don't want to..."
"Wally?" he frowned. Walter Hamner was about their only crosstown friend. He worked for a local ad agency. "Doesn't he know we're, you know, separated?"
"He knows, but you know, Walt, things like that don't faze him much."
Indeed, they didn't. Just thinking about Walter made him smile. Walter, always threatening to quit advertising in favor of advanced truss design, composer of obscene limericks and even more obscene parodies of popular tunes, divorced twice and tagged hard both times. Now impotent, if you believed gossip, and in this case he thought the gossip was probably true. How long had it been since he had seen Walt? 4 months? 6? Too long. That might be fun, he said, and then a thought struck him. She scanned it from his face in her old way and said,
There won't be any laundry people there.
He and Steve Ordner know each other.
Well, yes, him.
She shrugged to show how unlikely she thought it was that him would be there, and the shrug turned into an elbow-holding little shiver. It was only about 25 degrees. Hey, go on in, he said. You'll freeze, dummy.
Do you want to go?
I don't know. I'll have to think about it. He kissed her again, this time a little more firmly, and she kissed back. At a moment like this, he could regret everything. But the regret was far away. Clinical.
Merry Christmas, Bart,
she said, and he saw she was crying a little. Next year will be better, he said, the phrase comforting, but without any root meaning. Go inside before you catch pneumonia. She went in, and he drove away, still thinking about Wally Hamner's New Year's Eve party. He thought he would go. December 24, 1973. He found a small garage in Norton that would replace the broken back window for $90. When he asked the garage man if he would be working the day before Christmas, the garage man said, Hell yes, I'll take it any way I can get it. He stopped on the way at a Norton U-Wash It and put his clothes in two machines. He automatically rotated the agitators to see what kind of shape the spring drives were in, and then loaded them carefully so each machine would extract, only in the laundromats they called it spin-dry, without kicking off on the overload. He paused, smiling a little. You can take the boy out of the laundry, Fred, but you can't take the laundry out of the boy. Right, Fred? Fred? Oh, fuck yourself. That's a hell of a hole, the garage man said, peering at the spider-webbed glass. Kid with the snowball, he said. Rock in the middle of it. It was, he said. It really was. When the window was replaced, he drove back to the U-Wash It, put his clothes in the dryer, set it to medium hot, and put 30 cents in the slot. He sat down and picked up someone's discarded newspaper. The U-Wash It's only other customer was a tired-looking young woman with wire-rimmed glasses and blonde streaks in her long reddish-brown hair. She had a small girl with her, and the small girl was throwing a tantrum.
I want my bottle!
God damn it, Rachel!
Bottle!
Daddy's going to spank you when we get home, the young woman promised grimly, and no treats before bed.
Bottle!
Now why does a young girl like that want to streak her hair, he wondered, and looked at the paper. The headline said, Small Crowds in Bethlehem, Pilgrims Fear Holy Terror. On the bottom of page 1, a short news story caught his eye, and he read it carefully. Winterberger says acts of vandalism will not be tolerated. Local. Victor Winterberger, Democratic candidate for the seat of the late Donald P. Nash, who was killed in a car crash last month, said yesterday that acts of vandalism such as the one that caused almost $100,000 worth of damage at the Route 784 construction site early last Wednesday cannot be tolerated in a civilized American city. Winterberger made his remarks at an American Legion dinner and received a standing ovation. We have seen what has happened in other cities, Winterberger said. The defaced buses and subway cars and buildings in New York, the broken windows and senselessly marred schools of Detroit and San Francisco, the abuse of public facilities, public museums, public galleries. We must not allow the greatest country in the world to be overrun with Huns and barbarians. Police were called to the Grand Street area of the construction when a number of fires and explosions were seen by... Continued page 5, column 2. He folded the paper and put it on top of a tattered pile of magazines. The washer hummed and hummed a low soporific sound. Huns. Barbarians. They were the Huns. They were the rippers and chewers and chompers, turning people out of their homes, kicking apart lives as a small boy might kick apart an anthill. The young woman dragged her daughter, still crying for a bottle, out of the U-washit. He closed his eyes and dozed off, waiting for his dryer to finish. A few minutes later, he snapped awake, thinking he heard fire bells. But it was only a Salvation Army Santa who had taken up his position on the corner out front. When he left the laundry with his basket of clothes, he threw all his pocket change into Santa's pot.
"God bless you," Santa said.
December 25, 1973. The telephone woke him around 10 in the morning. He fumbled the extension off the night table, put it to his ear, and an operator said crisply into his sleep,
"Will you accept a collect call from Olivia Brenner?"
He was lost and could only fumble. "What? Who? I'm asleep." A distant, slightly familiar voice said,
"Oh, for Christ's sake."
And he knew. "Yes," he said. "I'll take it." Had she hung up on him? He got up on one elbow to see. "Olivia? You there?"
"Go ahead, please."
The operator overrode him, not willing to vary her psalm. "Olivia, are you there?"
"I'm here."
The voice was crackling and distant. "I'm glad you called."
"I didn't think you'd take the call."
"I just woke up. Are you there? In Las Vegas?"
"Yes,"
she said flatly. The word came out with curious, dull authority, like a plank dropped on a cement floor. "Well, how is it? How are you doing?" Her sigh was so bitter that it was almost a tearless sob.
"Not so good."
"No?"
"I met a guy my third night here. Went to a party and got so fucked up."
"Dope?" he asked cautiously, very aware that this was long distance and the government was everywhere.
"Dope?" she echoed crossly. "Of course it was dope. Bad shit. Full of decks or something. I think I got raped."
The last trailed off so badly that he had to ask, "What?"
"Raped!"
she screamed, so loudly that the receiver distorted.
"That's when some stupid jock playing Friday Night Hippie plays hide the salami with you while your brains are somewhere behind you, dripping off the wall. Rape? Do you know what rape is?"
"I know," he said.
"Bullshit, you know.
Do you need money?"
"Why ask me that? I can't fuck you over the telephone. I can't even hand job you."
"I have some money," he said. "I could send it, that's all. That's why." Instinctively, he found himself speaking not soothingly, but softly, so she would have to slow down and listen.
Yeah.
"Do you have an address?"
"General Delivery, that's my address."
"You don't have an apartment?"
"Yeah, me and this other sad sack have got a place. The mailboxes are all broken. Never mind. You keep the money. I've got a job. Screw, I think I'm going to quit and come back. Merry Christmas to me."
"What's the job?"
"Pushing hamburgers in this fast food joint. They got slots in the lobby, and people play them and eat hamburgers all night long. Can you believe it? The last thing you have to do when your shift is over is to wipe off all the handles of the slot machines. They get all covered with mustard and mayo and catsup. And you should see the people here. All of them are fat. They've either got tans or burns. And if they don't want to fuck you, you're just part of the furniture. I've had offers from both sexes. Thank God my roomie's about as sex-oriented as a juniper bush. Oh, Christ, why am I telling you all this? I don't even know why I called you. I'm going to hitch out of here at the end of the week when I get paid."
He heard himself say, "Give it a month."
"What?"
"Don't go chicken shit. If you leave now, you'll always wonder what you went out there for."
"Did you play football in high school?" "I bet you did."
"I wasn't even the water boy."
"Then you don't know anything, do you?"
"I'm thinking about killing myself."
"You don't even..." "What did you say?"
"I'm thinking about killing myself." He said it calmly. He was no longer thinking about long distance and the people who might monitor long distance just for the fun of it. Ma Bell, the White House, the CIA, the FBI. I keep trying things, and they keep not working. It's because I'm a little too old for them to work, I think. Something went wrong a few years ago, and I knew it was a bad thing, but I didn't know it was bad for me. I thought it just happened, and then I was going to get over it. But things keep falling down inside me. I'm sick with it. I keep doing things.
"Have you got cancer?"
she whispered. "I think I do."
"You want to go to a hospital. Get..."
"It's soul cancer."
"You're ego-tripping, man."
"Maybe so," he said. "It doesn't matter. One way or the other, things are set, and they'll turn out the way they will. Only one thing that bothers me, and that's a feeling I get from time to time, that I'm a character in some bad writer's book, and he's already decided how things are going to turn out and why. It's easier to see things that way, even, than to blame it on God. What did he ever do for me, one way or the other? No, it's this bad writer. It's his fault. He cut my son down by writing in a brain tumor. That was chapter one. Suicide or no suicide, that comes just before the epilogue. It's a stupid story."
"Listen," she said, troubled. "If they have one of those Dial Help outfits in your town, maybe you ought to..."
"They couldn't do anything for me," he said. "And it doesn't matter. I want to help you. For Christ's sake, look around out there before you go chicken shit. Get off dope. You said you were going to. The next time you look around, you'll be 40, and your options will mostly be gone."
"No, I can't take this. Some other place..."
"All places are the same, unless your mind changes. There's no magic place to get your mind right. If you feel like shit, everything you see looks like shit. I know that. Newspaper headlines, even the signs I see, they all say, 'Yeah, that's right, Georgie, pull the plug. This eats the bird.'"
"Listen."
"No, no, you listen. Dig your ears out. Getting old is like driving through snow that just gets deeper and deeper. When you finally get in over your hubcaps, you just spin and spin. That's life. There are no plows to come and dig you out. Your ship isn't going to come in, girl. There are no boats for nobody. You're never going to win a contest. There's no camera following you and people watching you struggle. This is it. All of it. Everything."
"You don't know what it's like here," she cried.
"No, but I know what it's like here."
"You're not in charge of my life."
"I'm going to send you $500. Olivia Brenner, care of General Delivery, Las Vegas."
"I won't be here. They'll send it back."
"They won't, because I'm not going to put on a return address."
"Throw it away, then."
"Use it to get a better job."
"No."
"Then use it for toilet paper," he said shortly, and hung up. His hands were shaking. The phone rang 5 minutes later. The operator said,
"Will you accept?"
"No," he said, and hung up. The phone rang twice more that day, but it was not Olivia, either time. Around 2 p.m, Mary called him from Bob and Janet Preston's house. Bob and Janet, who always reminded him, like it or not, of Fred and Wilma Flintstone. How was he? Good. A lie. What was he doing for Christmas dinner? Going out to Old Custom House tonight for turkey with all the trimmings. A lie. Would he like to come over here instead? Janet had all kinds of leftovers and would be happy to get rid of some. No, he really wasn't very hungry at the minute. The truth. He was pretty well looped, and on the spur of the moment he told her he would come to Walter's party. She sounded pleased. Did he know it was BYOB? When did Wally Hamner have a party that wasn't, he asked, and she laughed. They hung up, and he went back to sit in front of the TV with a drink. The phone rang again around 7:30, and by that time he was nothing as polite as looped. He was pissy-assed drunk.
Hello? Dawes?
Dawes here. Who's there?
Magliori, Dawes. Sal Magliori.
He blinked and peered into his glass. He looked at the Zenith Color TV, where he had been watching a movie called Home for the Holidays. It was about a family that had gathered at their dying patriarch's house on Christmas Eve, and somebody was murdering them, one by one. Very Christmassy.
"Mr. Magliori," he said, pronouncing carefully. "Merry Christmas, sir, and the best of everything in the new year." "Oh, if only you knew how I dread 74," Magliori said dolefully. "That's the year the oil barons are going to take over the country, Dawes. You see if they don't. Look at my sales sheet for December, if you don't believe me. I sold a 1971 Chevy Impala the other day. This car is clean as a whistle, and I sold it for $1,000. $1,000! Do you believe that? A 45% knockdown in 1 year. But I can sell all the 71 Vegas I can get my hands on for $1,500-$1,600. And what are they, I ask you?"
"Little cars?" he asked cautiously.
"They're fucking Maxwell House coffee cans, that's what they are," Magliori shouted. "Saltine boxes on wheels. Every time you look at the goddamn things cross-eyed and say booga booga at them, the engine's out of tune or the exhaust system drops off or the steering linkage is gone. Pintos, Vegas, Gremlins, they're all the same. Little suicide boxes. So I'm selling those as fast as I can get them, and I can't move a nice Chevy Impala unless I fucking give it away. And you say Happy New Year? Jesus, Mary, Joseph the Carpenter."
"That's seasonal," he said.
"I didn't call about that anyway," Magliori answered. "I called to say congratulations."
"Congratulations?" He was honestly bewildered.
"You know, crackle, crackle, boom, boom."
"Oh,
you mean shh, not on the phone. Be cool, Dawes."
"Sure. Crackle, crackle, boom, boom. That's good," he cackled.
"It was you, wasn't it, Dawes? To you, I wouldn't admit my middle name."
Magliori roared.
"That's good. You're good, Dawes. You're a fruitcake, but you're a clever fruitcake. I admire that."
"Thanks," he said, and cleverly knocked back the rest of his drink.
"I also wanted to tell you that everything was going ahead on schedule down there. Rumble and roar."
"What?" The glass he was holding fell from his fingers and rolled across the rug.
"They've got seconds on all that stuff, Dawes. Thirds on most of it. They're paying cash until they got their bookwork straightened out, but everything is right on."
"You're crazy."
"No. I thought you ought to know. I told you, Dawes, some things you can't get rid of."
"You're a bastard. You're lying. Why do you want to call a man up on Christmas night and tell him lies?"
"I ain't lying. It's your play again, Dawes. In this game, it's always gonna be your play."
"I don't believe you."
"You poor son of a bitch," Magliori said.
He sounded honestly sorry, and that was the worst part.
"I don't think it's gonna be a very happy new year for you either."
He hung up. And that was Christmas. December 26, 1973. There was a letter from them in the mail. He had begun to see the anonymous people downtown that way, the personal pronoun in italics and printed in drippy, ominous letters like the printing on a horror movie poster, as if to confirm what Magliori had said. He held it in his hand, looking down at the crisp, white business envelope, his mind filled with almost all the bad emotions the human mind can feel. Despair, hatred, fear, anger, loss. He almost tore it into small pieces and threw it into the snow beside the house, and then knew he couldn't do that. He opened it, nearly tearing the envelope in half, and realized that what he felt most was cheated. He had been gypped. He had been rooked. He had destroyed their machines and their records, and they had just brought up a few replacements.
It was like trying to fight the Chinese army single-handed.
It's your play again, Dawes. In this game, it's always going to be your play.
The other letters had been form jobs, sent from the office of the highway department. Dear friend, a big crane is going to come to your house sometime soon. Be on the lookout for this exciting event as we improve your city. This was from the city council, and it was personal. It said, December 20, 1973. Mr. Barton G. Dawes, 1241 Crestallen Street West, M.W. Dear Mr. Dawes, it has come to our attention that you are the last resident of Crestallen Street West who has not relocated. We trust that you are experiencing no undue problems in this matter. While we have a 19642-A form on file, Acknowledgement of Information Concerning City Roads Project 6983-426-73-74-HC, we do not yet have your relocation form 6983-426-73-74-HC-9004, blue folder. As you know, we cannot begin processing your check of reimbursement without this form. According to our 1973 tax assessment, the property at 1241 Crestallen Street West has been valued at $63,500. And so we are sure that you must be as aware of the situation's urgency as we are. By law, you must relocate by January 20, 1974, the date that demolitions work is scheduled to begin on Crestallen Street West. We must also point out again that according to the State Statute of Eminent Domain, SL19452-36, you would be in violation of the law to remain in your present location past midnight of January 19, 1974. We are sure you understand this, but we are pointing it out once more so that the record will be clear. If you are having some problem with relocation, I hope you will call me during business hours, or better yet, stop by and discuss the situation. I am sure that things can be worked out. You will find us more than eager to cooperate in this matter. In the meantime, may I wish you a Merry Christmas and a most productive New Year? Sincerely, for the City Council, JTG/TK. No, he muttered. You may not wish it. You may not. He tore the letter to shreds and threw it in the wastebasket. That night, sitting in front of the Zenith TV, he found himself thinking about how he and Mary had found out, almost 42 months ago now, that God had decided to do a little road work on their son Charlie's brain. The doctor's name had been Younger. There was a string of letters after his name on the framed diplomas that hung on the warmly paneled walls of his inner office, but all he understood for sure was that Younger was a neurologist, a fast man with a good brain disease. He and Mary had gone to see him at Younger's request on a warm June afternoon, 19 days after Charlie had been admitted to Doctor's Hospital. He was a good-looking man, maybe halfway through his 40s, physically fit from a lot of golf played with no electric golf cart. He was tanned a deep Cordovan shade, and the doctor's hands fascinated him. They were huge hands, clumsy-looking, but they moved about his desk, now picking up a pen, now riffling through his appointment book, now playing idly across the surface of a silver-inlaid paperweight, with a lissom grace that was very nearly repulsive. "Your son has a brain tumor," he said. He spoke flatly, with little inflection, but his eyes watched them very carefully, as if he had just armed a temperamental explosive. "Tumor?" Mary said softly, blankly. "How bad is it?" he asked Younger. The symptoms had developed over the space of 8 months. First, the headaches, infrequent at the beginning, then more common. Then, double vision that came and went, particularly after physical exercise. After that, most shameful to Charlie, some incidents of bedwetting.
But they had not taken him to the family doctor until a terrifying temporary blindness in the left eye, which had gone as red as a sunset, obscuring Charlie's good blue. The family doctor had had him admitted for tests, and the other symptoms had followed that. Phantom smells of oranges and shaved pencils, occasional numbness in the left hand, occasional lapses into nonsense and childish obscenity. "It's bad," Younger said. "You must prepare yourself for the worst. It is inoperable." Inoperable. The word echoed up the years to him. He had never thought words had taste, but that one did. It tasted bad and yet juicy at the same time, like rotten hamburger cooked rare. Inoperable. Somewhere, Younger said, deep in Charlie's brain, was a collection of bad cells roughly the size of a walnut. If you had that collection of bad cells in front of you on the table, you could squash them with one hard hit, but they weren't on the table. They were deep in the meat of Charlie's mind, still smugly growing, filling him with random strangeness. One day, not long after his admission, he had been visiting his son on his lunch break. They had been talking about baseball, discussing, in fact, whether or not they would be able to go to the American League baseball playoffs if the city's team won. Charlie had said,
"I think if their pitching pitching staff holds up pitching..."
He had leaned forward.
"What, Fred? I'm not tracking you."
Charlie's eyes had rolled wildly outward.
"Fred?"
George whispered.
"Freddy!" "Goddamn motherfucking mother-sucking fuckhole!"
his son screamed from the clean white hospital bed.
"Cunt-licking, dick-rubbing, ass-wiped son of a whoring bitch!"
"Nurse!" he had screamed as Charlie passed out.
"Oh, God, nurse!"
It was the cells, you see, that had made him talk like that. A little bunch of bad cells no bigger, say, than your average-sized walnut. Once the night nurse said, he had screamed the word boondoggle again and again for nearly 5 minutes. Just bad cells, you know. No bigger than your garden variety walnut. Making his son rave like an insane dock walloper. Making him wet the bed, giving him headaches, making him, during the first hot week of that July, lose all ability to move his left hand. "Look," Dr. Younger had told him on that bright, just-right-for-golf June day. He had unrolled a long scroll of paper, an ink tracing of their son's brain waves. He produced a healthy brain wave as a comparison, but he didn't need it. He looked at what had been going on in his son's head and again felt that rotten yet juicy taste in his mouth. The paper showed an irregular series of spiky mountains and valleys, like a series of badly drawn daggers. Inoperable. You see, if that collection of bad cells, no bigger than a walnut, had decided to grow on the outside of Charlie's brain, minor surgery would have vacuumed it right up. No sweat, no strain, no pain on the brain, as they had said when they were boys. But instead, it had grown down deep inside and was growing larger every day. If they tried the knife, or laser, or cryosurgery, they would be left with a nice, healthy, breathing piece of meat. If they didn't try any of those things, soon they would be bundling their boy into a coffin. Dr. Younger said all these things in generalities, covering their lack of options in a soothing foam of technical language that would wear away soon enough. Mary kept shaking her head in gentle bewilderment, but he had understood everything exactly and completely. His first thought, bright and clear, never to be forgiven, was, "Thank God it's not me." And the funny taste came back, and he began to grieve for his son. Today a walnut, tomorrow the world, the creeping unknown, the incredible dying son. What was there to understand? Charlie died in October. There were no dramatic dying words. He had been in a coma for 3 weeks. He sighed and went out to the kitchen and made himself a drink. Dark night pressed evenly on all the windows. The house was so empty now that Mary was gone. He kept stumbling over little pieces of himself everywhere. Snapshots, his old sweatsuit in an upstairs closet, an old pair of slippers under the bureau. It was bad, very bad, to keep doing that. He had never cried over Charlie after Charlie's death, not even at the funeral. Mary had cried a great deal, for weeks, it seemed. Mary had gone around with a perpetual case of pink eye, but in the end, she had been the one to heal. Charlie had left scars on her, that was undeniable. Outwardly, she had all the scars, Mary before and after. Before, she would not take a drink unless she considered it socially helpful to his future. She would take a weak screwdriver at a party and carry it around all night. A rum toddy before bed when she had a heavy chest cold, that was all. After, she had a cocktail with him in the late afternoon when he came home, and always a drink before bed. Not serious drinking by anyone's yardstick, not sick and puking in the bathroom drinking, but more than before. A little of that protective foam, undoubtedly just what the doctor would have ordered. Before, she rarely cried over little things. After, she cried over them often, always in private. If dinner was burned, if she had a flat. The time water got in the basement and the sump pump froze and the furnace shorted out. Before, she had been something of a folk music buff, white folk and blues. Van Ronk, Gary Davis, Tom Rush, Tom Paxton, Spider John Kerner. After, her interest just faded away. She sang her own blues and laments on some inner circuit. She had stopped talking about their taking a trip to England if he got promoted a step up. She started doing her hair at home, and the sight of her sitting in front of the TV in rollers became a common one. It was she their friends pitied, rightly so, he supposed. He wanted to pity himself, and did, but kept it a secret. She had been able to need and to use what was given to her because of her need, and eventually that had saved her. It had kept her from the awful contemplation that kept him awake so many nights, after her bedtime drink had lulled her off to sleep. And as she slept, he contemplated the fact that, in this world, a tiny collection of cells no bigger than a walnut could take a son's life and send him away forever. He had never hated her for healing, or for the deference other women gave her as a right. They looked on her the way a young oilman might look on an old vet, whose hand or back or cheek is shiny with puckered pink burn tissue, with the respect the never hurt always hold for the once hurt now healed. She had done her time in hell over Charlie, and these other women knew it, but she had come out. There had been before. There had been hell. There had been after. And there had even been after, when she had returned to two of her four social clubs, had taken up macrame. He had a belt she had done a year ago, a beautiful twisted rope creation with a heavy silver buckle monogrammed BGD. Had taken up afternoon TV, soap operas, and Merv Griffin chatting with the celebrities. Now what? He wondered, going back to the living room. After? It seemed so. A new woman, a whole woman, rising out of the old ashes that he had so crudely stirred. The old oil man with skin grafts over the burns, retaining the old savvy but gaining a new look. Beauty only skin deep. No. Beauty was in the eye of the beholder. It could go for miles. For him, the scars had all been inside. He had examined his hurts one by one on the long nights after Charlie's death, cataloging them with all the morbid fascination of a man studying his own bowel movements for signs of blood. He had wanted to watch Charlie play ball on a little league team. He had wanted to get report cards and rant over them. He wanted to tell him over and over to pick up his room. He wanted to worry about the girls Charlie saw, the friends he picked, the boy's internal weather. He wanted to see what his son became, and if they could still be in love as they had been until the bad cells, no bigger than a walnut, had come between them like some dark and rapacious woman. Mary had said, "He was yours." That was true. The two of them had fitted so well that names were ridiculous, even pronouns a little obscene. So they became George and Fred, a vaudeville sort of combination, two Mortimer Wiebelfeasers against the world. And if a collection of bad cells no bigger than a walnut could destroy all those things that are so personal that they can never be properly articulated, so personal you hardly dared admit their existence to yourself, what did that leave? How could you ever trust life again? How could you see it as anything more meaningful than a Saturday night demolition derby? All of it was inside him. But he had been honestly unaware that his thoughts were changing him so deeply, so irretrievably. And now it was all out in the open, like some obscene mess vomited onto a coffee table, reeking with stomach juice, filled with undigested lumps. And if the world was only a demo derby, wouldn't one be justified in stepping out of his car? But what after that? Life seemed only a preparation for hell. He saw that he had drained his drink in the kitchen. He had come into the living room with an empty glass. December 31, 1973. He was only two blocks from Wally Hamner's house when he put his hand into his overcoat pocket to see if he had any Canada mints in there. There were no mints, but he came up with a tiny square of aluminum foil that glinted dully in the station wagon's green dash lights. He spared it a puzzled, absent glance and was about to toss it into the ashtray when he remembered what it was. In his mind, Olivia's voice said, "Synthetic mescaline. Product 4, they call it. Very heavy stuff." He had forgotten all about it. He put the little foil packet back into his coat pocket and turned onto Walter's Street. Cars were lined up halfway down the block on both sides. That was Walter, all right. He had never been one to have anything so simple as a party when there might be a group grope in the offing. The principle of the pleasure push, Wally called it. He claimed that someday he would patent the idea and then publish instructional handbooks on how to use it. If you got enough people together, Wally Hamner maintained, you were forced into having a good time, pushed into it. Once, when Wally was expounding this theory in a bar, he had mentioned lynch mobs. "There," Walter had said blandly, "Bart has just proved my case." He wondered what Olivia was doing now. She hadn't tried to call back, although if she had, he would probably have weakened and taken the call. Maybe she had stayed in Vegas just long enough to get the money, and had then caught a bus for where? Maine? Did anyone leave Las Vegas for Maine in the middle of winter? Surely not.
Product 4, they call it. Very heavy stuff.
He snuggled the wagon up to the curb behind a sporty red GTX with a black racing stripe and got out. New Year's Eve was clear but bitterly cold. A frigid rind of moon hung in the sky overhead like a child's paper cutout. Stars were spangled around it in lavish profusion. The mucus in his nose froze to a glaze that crackled when he flared his nostrils. His breath plumed out on the dark air. Three houses away from Walter's, he picked up the bass line from the stereo. They really had it cranked. There was something about Wally's parties, he reflected, pleasure principle or no. The most well-intentioned of just-thought-we'd-drop-bys ended up staying and drinking until their heads were full of silver chimes that would turn to leaden church bells the next day. The most dyed-in-the-wool rock music haters ended up boogieing in the living room to the endless golden gassers that Wally trotted out when everybody got blind drunk enough to look back upon the late 50s and early 60s as the plateau of their lives. They drank and boogied, boogied and drank until they were panting like little yellow dogs on the 4th of July. There were more kisses in the kitchen by halves of differing holes, more feel-ups per square inch, more wallflowers jerked rudely out of the woodwork. More normally sober folk who would wake up on New Year's Day with groaning hangovers and hurriedly clear memories of prancing around with lampshades on their heads, or of finally deciding to tell the boss a few home truths. Wally seemed to inspire these things, not by any conscious effort, but just by being Wally. And of course there was no party like a New Year's Eve party. He found himself scanning the parked cars for Steve Ordner's bottle green Delta 88, but didn't see it anywhere. Closer to the house, the rest of the rock band coalesced around the persistent bass signature and Mick Jagger screaming. Every light in the house was blazing. Fuck the energy crisis. Except, of course, in the living room, where rub your peepees would be going on during the slow numbers. Even over the heavy drive of the amplified music, he could hear 100 voices raised in 50 different conversations, as if Babel had fallen only seconds ago. He thought that, had it been summer, or even fall, it would have been more fun to just stand outside, listening to the circus, charting its progress towards its zenith, and then its gradual fall-off. He had a sudden vision, startling, frightening, of himself standing on Wally Hamner's lawn and holding a roll of EEG graph paper in his hands, covered with the irregular spikes and dips of damaged mental function, the monitored record of a gigantic, tumored party brain. He shuddered a little and stuck his hands in his overcoat pockets to warm them. His right hand encountered the small foil packet again, and he took it out. Curious, he unfolded it, regardless of the cold that bit his fingertips with dull teeth. There was a small purple pill inside the foil, small enough to lie on the nail of his pinky finger without touching the edges. Much smaller than, say, a walnut. Could something as small as that make him clinically insane, cause him to see things that weren't there, think in a way he had never thought? Could it, in short, mime all the conditions of his son's mortal illness? Casually, almost absently, he put the pill in his mouth. It had no taste. He swallowed it.
"Bart!" the woman screamed. "Bart Dawes!"
It was a woman in a black off-the-shoulder evening dress with a martini in one hand. She had dark hair, put up for the occasion, and held with a glittering rope spangled with imitation diamonds. He had walked in through the kitchen door. The kitchen was choked, clogged with people. It was only 8:30. The tidal effect hadn't gotten far yet then. The tidal effect was another part of Walter's theory. As a party continued, he contended, people would migrate to the four corners of the house. "The center does not hold," Wally said, blinking wisely. T.S. Eliot said that. Once, according to Wally, he had found a guy wandering around in the attic 18 hours after the party ended. The woman in the black dress kissed him warmly on the lips, her ample breasts pushing against his chest. Some of her martini fell on the floor between them.
"Hi," he said. "Who's you?"
"Tina Howard, Bart. Don't you remember the class trip?"
She wagged a long, spade-shaped fingernail under his nose.
"Naughty boy!"
"That, Tina? By God, you are!"
A stunned grin spread his mouth. That was another thing about Walter's parties. People from your past kept turning up like old photographs. Your best friend on the block 30 years ago, the girl you almost laid once in college, some guy you had worked with for a month on a summer job 18 years ago.
"Except I'm Tina Howard Wallace now," the woman in the black dress said. "My husband's around here somewhere."
She looked around vaguely, spilled some more of her drink, and swallowed the rest before it could get away from her.
"Isn't it awful? I seem to have lost him."
She looked at him warmly, speculatively, and Bart could barely believe that this woman had given him his first touch of female flesh, the sophomore class trip at Grover Cleveland High School, 109 years ago, rubbing her breast through her white cotton sailor blouse beside
Cutter Stream, he said aloud.
She blushed and giggled.
"You remember all right."
His eyes dropped in a perfect, involuntary reflex to the front of her dress, and she shrieked with laughter. He grinned that helpless grin again.
"I guess time goes by faster than we..."
"Bart!"
Wally Hamner yelled over the general party babble.
"Hey, buddy! Really glad you could make it!"
He cut across the room to them with the also-to-be-patented Walter Hamner Party Zigzag. A thin man, now mostly bald, wearing an impeccable 1962 vintage pinstriped shirt and horn-rimmed glasses. He shook Walter's outstretched hand, and Walter's grip was as hard as he remembered.
"I see you met Tina Wallace," Walter said.
"Hell, we go way back when,"
he said, and smiled uncomfortably at Tina.
"Don't you tell my husband that, you naughty boy," Tina giggled. Excuse, please. I'll see you later, Bart.
Sure, he said. She disappeared around a clump of people gathered by a table loaded with chips and dips and went on into the living room. He nodded after her and said, How do you pick them, Walter? That girl was my first feel. It's like, this is your life. Walter shrugged modestly.
All a part of the pleasure, Push Barton, my boy.
He nodded at the paper bag tucked under his arm. What's in the plain brown wrapper? Southern comfort. You've got ginger ale, don't you?
Sure,
Walter said, but grimaced.
Are you really going to drink that down by the Swanee River stuff? I always thought you were a Scotch man.
I was always a private comfort and ginger ale man. I've come out of the closet. Walter grinned.
Mary's around here someplace. She's kind of been keeping an eye out for you. Get yourself a drink and we'll go find her.
Good enough. He made his way across the kitchen, saying hi to people he knew vaguely and who looked as if they didn't know him at all, and replying, Hi, how are you, to people he didn't remember who hailed him first. Cigarette smoke rolled majestically through the kitchen. Conversation faded quickly in and out, like stations on late-night AM radio, all of it bright and meaningless. Freddie and Jim didn't have their timesheets, so I
said that his mother died quite recently, and he's apt to go on a crying jag if he drinks too much.
So when he got the paint scraped off, he saw it was really a nice piece, maybe pre-revolutionary.
And this little kike came to the door selling encyclopedias. Very messy. He won't give her the divorce because of the kids, and he drinks like a terribly nice dress.
So much to drink that when he went to pay the check, he barfed all over the hostess.
A long formica-topped table had been set up in front of the stove and the sink, and it was already crowded with opened liquor bottles and glasses in varying sizes and degrees of fullness. Ashtrays already overflowed with filter tips. Three ice buckets filled with cubes had been crowded into the sink. Over the stove was a large poster which showed Richard Nixon wearing a pair of earphones. The earphone cord disappeared up into the rectum of a donkey standing on the edge of the picture. The caption said, We listen better. To the left, a man in bell-bottomed baggies and a drink in each hand, a water glass filled with what looked to be whiskey, and a large stein filled with beer, was entertaining a mixed group with a joke.
This guy comes into this bar, and here's this monkey sitting on the stool next to him. So the guy orders a beer, and when the bartender brings it, the guy says, Who owns this monkey? Cute little bugger. And the bartender says, Oh, that's the piano player's monkey. So the guy swings around.
He made himself a drink and looked around for Walt, but he had gone to the door to greet some more guests, a young couple. The man was wearing a huge driving cap, goggles, and an old-time automobile duster. Written on the front of the duster were the words, Keep on truckin'. Several people were laughing uproariously, and Walter was howling. Whatever the joke was, it seemed to go back a long time.
And the guy walks over to the piano player and says, Do you know your monkey just pissed in my beer? And the piano player says, No, but hum a few bars and I'll fake it.
Calculated bursts of laughter. The man in the bell-bottom baggie sipped his whiskey and then cooled it with a gulp of beer. He took his drink and strolled into the darkened living room, slipping behind the turned back of Tina Howard Wallace before she could see him and snag him into a long game of Where Are They Now? She looked, he thought, like the kind of person who could cite you chapter and verse from the lives of classmates who had turned out badly. Divorce, nervous disorders, and criminal violations would be her stock in trade, and would have made unpersons out of those who had had success. Someone had put on the inevitable album of 50s rock and roll, and maybe 15 couples were jitterbugging hilariously and badly. He saw Mary dancing with a tall, slim man that he knew but could not place. Jack? John? Jason? He shook his head. It wouldn't come. Mary was wearing a party dress he had never seen before. It buttoned up one side, and she had left enough buttons undone to provide a sexy slit to a little above one nylon knee. He waited for some strong feeling, jealousy or loss, even habitual craving. But none came. He sipped his drink. She turned her head and saw him. He raised a noncommittal finger in salute. Go on and finish your dance. But she broke off and came over, bringing her partner with her.
I'm so glad you could come, Bart,
she said, raising her voice to be heard over the laughter and conversation and stereo. "Do you remember Dick Jackson?"
Bart stuck out his hand, and the slim man shook it. "You and your wife lived on our street 7 years ago, is that right?" Jackson nodded. "We're out in Willowwood now."
Housing development, he thought. He had become very sensitive to the city's geography and housing strata.
"Good enough. Are you still working for Peel's?"
"No. I've got my own business now. 2 trucks. Tri-state haulers. Say, if that laundry of yours ever needs day hauling, chemicals or any of that stuff."
"I don't work for the laundry anymore," he said, and saw Mary wince slightly, as if someone had knuckled an old bruise.
"No? What are you doing now?"
"Self-employed," he said, and grinned. "Were you in on that independent trucker's strike?" Jackson's face, already dark with alcohol, darkened more.
"You're goddamn right. And I personally untracked a guy that couldn't see falling into line. Do you know what those miserable Ohio bastards are charging for diesel? 31.9. That takes my profit margin from 12% and cuts it right down to 9. And all my truck maintenance has got to come out of that 9, not to mention the friggin' double nickel speed limit."
As he went on about the perils of independent trucking in the country that had suddenly developed a severe case of the energy bends, Bart listened and nodded in the right places and sipped his drink. Mary excused herself and went into the kitchen to get a glass of punch. The man in the automobile duster was doing an exaggerated Charleston to an old Everly Brothers number, and people were laughing and applauding. Jackson's wife, a busty, muscular-looking girl with carroty red hair, came over and was introduced. She was quite near the stagger point. Her eyes looked like the tilt signs on a pinball machine. She shook hands with him, smiled glassily, and then said to Dick Jackson,
"Hon, I think I'm going to whoopsie. Where's the bathroom?"
Jackson led her away. He skirted the dance floor and sat down in one of the chairs along the side. He finished his drink. Mary was slow coming back. Someone had collared her into her conversation, he supposed. He reached into an inside pocket and brought out a pack of cigarettes and lit one. He only smoked at parties now. That was quite a victory over a few years ago, when he had been part of the 3-packs-a-day cancer brigade. He was halfway through the cigarette and still watching the kitchen door for Mary, when he happened to glance down at his fingers and saw how interesting they were. It was interesting how the first and second fingers of his right hand knew just how to hold the cigarette, as if they had been smoking all their lives. The thought was so funny he had to smile. It seemed that he had been examining his fingers for quite a while when he noticed his mouth tasted different. Not bad, just different. The spit in it seemed to have thickened, and his legs. His legs felt a little jittery, as if they would like to tap along with the music, as if tapping along with the music would relieve them, make them feel cool and just like legs again. He felt a little frightened at the way that thought, which had begun so ordinarily, had gone corkscrewing off in a wholly new direction like a man lost in a big house and climbing a tall crystal staircase. There it was again. And it was probably the pill he had taken, Olivia's pill. Yes. And wasn't that an interesting way to say crystal? Crystal? Gave it a crusty, bangled sound, like a stripper's costume. He smiled craftily and looked at his cigarette, which seemed amazingly white, amazingly round, amazingly symbolic of all America's padding and wealth. Only in America were cigarettes so good-tasting. He had a puff. Wonderful. He thought of all the cigarettes in America, pouring off the production lines in Winston-Salem, a plethora of cigarettes, an endless, clean, white cornucopia of them. It was the mescaline, all right. He was starting to trip. And if people knew what he had been thinking about the word crystal, a.k.a. crystal, they would nod and tap their heads. Yes, he's crazy, all right. Nutty as a fruitcake. Fruitcake, there was another good word. He suddenly wished Sal Magliore was here. Together, he and Sally One-Eye would discuss all the facets of the organization's business. They would discuss old whores and shootings. In his mind's eye, he saw Sally One-Eye and himself eating linguine in a small Italian ristorante with dark-toned walls and scarred wooden tables while the strains of The Godfather played on the soundtrack.
all in luxurious technicolor that you could fall into, bathe in like a bubble bath. Crystal, he said under his breath, and grinned. It seemed that he had been sitting here and going over one thing and another for a very long time, but no ash had grown on his cigarette at all. He was astounded. He had another puff.
Bart?
He looked up. It was Mary, and she had a canapé for him. He smiled at her.
Sit down.